ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And a welcome back with Fight Night Picks and a big time card coming up this weekend, UFC 276. You have Adesanya taking on Cannonier. You have a refreshed and recycled third iteration of Volkanovski taking on Max Holloway. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. Matt Allen FNP, last weekend, heck of a weekend for Fight Night Picks. You folks make question mark kicks an insane success, and we want to thank everybody who was able to tune into that show. And of course, with this week being a pay-per-view, question mark kicks 2 hours live before those early prelims start. But we also have the Fight Night Picks sidekick coming up. That one's going to be live for the main card. And there's so many intriguing matchups, whether it's Munoz O'Malley, whether it's those two title fights. You've got Pereira Strickland. So many different fights to choose from, Matt. But I know we're going top to bottom through this pay-per-view card. Fight Matrix have this as a 4.5 out of 5-star card. It never gets better than that. This is one of the better cards you're going to find this year, and I cannot wait for it. International Fight Week, getting it started. Man, this is a good one.
I don't care about the Fight Matrix. To me, it's 5 out of 5 stars without a doubt. This is one of the better cards you are going to find. Like you said, we have a trilogy for a title in the co-main event, and it's not like, oh, they fought each other when they were on the come-up, and then they fought twice when they got the title. All three fights have been for the championship, which is exactly wild. And for Max Holloway, we all know how good he looked his last time out against Yair Rodriguez. Hopefully he is trying to build even more off of that performance, because he's going to need something new in this fight to be able to beat Volkanovski, because it is wild. Max Holloway, one of the greatest fighters of all time. I wonder if it will be held against him in the future, like, he was never able to beat Volkanovski, because if Alexander is able to go 3-0 against an all-time great, that's one of the best, really, resume fillers we've ever seen in this sport. And that's not even the main event. Israel Adesanya and Jared Cannonier, this is the one guy who Izzy hasn't fought, either on his way up to the title or now that he has the title. So this is a really interesting matchup. Cannonier's been in there with a lot of really good guys. I know he hasn't always beat them. He's lost to Robert Whittaker, of course, but I do think Cannonier's going to offer a lot of different wrinkles for the champion in this fight.
We'll have to see how the power and the crystals play out for Jared Cannonier, but it will be an interesting matchup. If you know anything about Fight Night Picks, we're going to throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. And of course, when you look at this card, we did lose Murphy versus Tate. Spoiler alert, that wasn't in contention for the fight of the night, but we do want to hear from you down below in the comments section. Who do you have as that possible fight of the night?
Let us know down below in the comments section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
So when we have a look at this screen, I mean, Brad Riddell taking on Jalen Turner at 155 pounds. This is Jalen Turner's first opportunity in the lightweight division to take on a ranked opponent. He's been buzzsawing through previous guys. And when you look at it, Brad Riddell beat Jamie Mullerkey, withstood a little bit of adversity in that fight. Jalen Turner cut through knife in a hot butter, you know?
You're big on hot butter, which is oil that's a liquid.
I'm having fun with hot butter, but when it comes to Jalen Turner, he also had fun with hot butter. He was that hot knife. And when we do look at this matchup, though, Matt, Brad Riddell, he is so, so sneaky with the striking. We know him as that former Tiger Muay Thai striking coach, but oh, by the way, go have a look at some of his wins. He mixes in the wrestling with his overall attack. For Jalen Turner, the guy's nickname's the Tarantula. He could fight with 8 limbs, 6 limbs, or the 4 that he's been afforded. But you watch the way that this guy fights, mixing his punches, his kicks, and his slick, slick ground game. I think this is going to be an amazing fight.
This should be a really fun fight. For Brad Riddell, he's had a very high level of competition since coming into the UFC. And honestly, the same thing could be said for Jalen Turner. The difference is, Turner didn't get off to the best start because he fought one of the best guys in a weight class that he doesn't belong to in Vicente Luque at welterweight. But ever since he has gone back down to 155 pounds, he has not only been one of the best fighters in the weight class, but one of the most exciting too. And the same thing has to be said for Brad Riddell. Two guys with great chins and phenomenal striking. I think this fight's going to be incredible.
Absolutely wild. It should be a great one. And listen, hot pick, cool pick, I don't know what it is, but we'll see what happens. I mean, Pedro Munoz, the young Punisher, taking on Sugar Sean O'Malley. For O'Malley, has that lone blip on the radar since he came in off Dana White's Contender Series in his overall record, so to speak. 15-1, the loss is to Chito Vera, and there's always murmurs, there's always rumblings. Everybody wants to see that rematch. We're not going to get it this weekend, but a heck of a fight nonetheless. O'Malley gets to take on his first ranked opponent in this division when he takes on Munoz, who's 1-4 in his last five fights. He's got arguments in a few of them, but listen, this guy is a tricky, tricky fighter to figure out, and only some of those upper echelon guys have been the ones to figure him out.
And that's why I think this fight's so much fun. I say this all the time now. My favorite type of fights are the hyped-up prospect who has some unknown qualities in their game versus the much more established guy who, yes, they might have wins, yes, they might have losses, but still, we know what they look like against the top fighters in this division, and that's exactly what Pedro Munoz is. Again, he might not always beat the top five guys, but they're always competitive and they're always very fun fights. And for Sean O'Malley, like you said, stumbling block against Chito Vera, which in hindsight is, I mean, as far as aging losses go, that's really as good as any other loss out there, because we all know how good Chito Vera looks. Hopefully we get a 5-round rematch of that sometime in the near future, because that'd be an incredible fight. But this one for Sean O'Malley, it's a really big litmus test, because again, we all know how good he can look against guys coming up in weight. Other fighters who maybe shouldn't be in there with him in the first place. I don't think anybody's arguing that Pedro Munoz should not be in this opportunity against O'Malley. So this should be an incredible fight.
Good opportunity for both of these guys. Again, let us know down below in the comments section who you have in the possible fight of the night screen. So many different ones to go over. Listen, we didn't even talk about that trilogy fight. That could be in here too. Lot of performance go-getters on this pay-per-view. So fill up that comment section. No wrong answers. So when you look at the overall MMA landscape this week, you do have a big-time fight. Julia Budd, challenging, taking on Kayla Harrison with the PFL on Friday night. You have Ryzen as well. Kai Asakura's got a big-time title defense coming up. But when it comes specifically to this UFC card, plenty of ranked fighters, 11 of them ranked, plus two champions out there. You do not have any UFC debuts, so these are all fighters that you know and love. And there's plenty of fighters that have a lot of pay-per-view experience. Like, if you just look at Sean O'Malley, you consider the record 7-1, plus that includes the fight that he had on Dana White's Contender Series. His only fight that hasn't been on pay-per-view in the UFC was when he fought in his debut against Tarion Ware in the Ultimate Fighter finale. So Sean O'Malley is a giant centerpiece of the overall week, and I know there's a lot of people that get excited about his fights, but Matt, I gotta say, like, there's some hardcores, delights type of fights, like Donald Cerrone, Jim Miller on short notice, and Robbie Lawler, Brian Barberina are absolute madness, and you know we're there for it.
And what I really love about this card too is the UFC is doing something that it used to just be common practice for them. How many times did we see a featherweight title being contested in the main event, and one of the showcase fights on that main card be sort of a number one contendership for that fight? Sean Strickland versus Alex Pereira is the number one contender fight for the belt that's being contested in the main event. So what I really like about this whole card is that the second it's over, we kind of know what's next for some of these athletes right away. Let's say Pereira is able to go in there, use all that kickboxing experience to get people really excited for the next fight with Izzy. How big of a fight would that be? You have former kickboxing stars coming over, transitioning their games into MMA and then proving that they're some of the best in this sport. Or Sean Strickland, who was on this weird, like, journeyman's trip through welterweight, moved up in weight, and now he looks like an absolute world beater at this weight class. I think that's a tremendous fight that's really flown under the radar.
Reminds me a lot of UFC 217, Paulo Costa, Johnny Hendricks. A lot of striker versus a wrestler that can mix it up. And of course, we know how good Sean Strickland's striking is and how great he's looked at middleweight since that move up in about 2020. So, an amazing slate of fights. We've got 12 of them in total as of now, Sunday night when we're taping. Murphy and Misha Tate is off the card, but if anything changes, make sure you keep it locked in with the channel. If you're not subscribed, toss that sub, toss the bell notification so you know when the shows go live, but when those videos drop. So Matt, we have a lot to talk about when it comes to this card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. To kick off the card at the women's bantamweight division, we have Jessica Rose Clark taking on Yulia Stolyarenko, and it has to be said, if you go onto the UFC's website and you look at the fan rankings, sometimes you can pick up on certain things that other people might not know. There might be fighters that have joined the UFC that haven't really been talked about all that much. There might have been fighters that are dropped. UFC Roster Watch on Twitter, I'm looking at you.
A good follow.
But when you go on the UFC's fan rankings and you strip out all the ranked fighters, now all of that includes Norma Dumont, who's at 15, but is she a bantamweight? Is she truly a featherweight? So I'm going to say that Norma Dumont's a featherweight. I take that list, and then I take the list of fighters that I can pick out of the pool. There's six other fighters in this division that are not ranked. So if you win, all of a sudden you're ranked. Wow. And that includes the two fighters that you have coming up to kick off this pay-per-view card and Jessica Rose Clark and Yulia Stoyanenko. They're joined there by Jocelyn Edwards, Stephanie Edgar, Tainara Lisboa, who hasn't even fought in the UFC, Bia Malecki, who got beat by, well, you know her, Josiane Nunes, and of course, Yulia Stoyanenko. So it's slim pickings in this division. And then you have a look at the two fighters that are here. And for Jessica Rose Clark, she comes into the UFC and has, I guess, as big of a push she could have. Like, you're fighting big, big names like Paige VanZant. Matt, what do you make of that?
I don't know if she got the biggest push, to be honest, because at that time, Paige was a little bit past her prime, and people weren't really looking at VanZant as being a real contender at that stage of her career. I will agree with you, though, there was more than average hype for Jessica Rose Clark coming in. Again, my go-to fighter for this is always Emil Mech, because for some reason, he was pretty popular, but he never had a big win. It just always felt like
a lot of Venator fans out there.
But he did have a few things that set him apart. He was active on social media, he had the axe and stuff, he had that really unique look, so there were always a few things that would set him apart from your average unranked fighter. And for Jessica Rose Clark, she did have that really big win over VanZant, who again, wasn't necessarily at the peak of her career. And honestly, that fight was terrible. Go back and watch it. It's a lot of Jessica Rose Clark laying on top of Paige VanZant, not doing a lot with her top position, just kind of riding out the rounds. And that's the thing about Jessica Rose Clark. She does have really good wrestling. I would say that's sort of the foundation of her whole game plan. She's someone who will recklessly just strike into the clinch and try to go for takedowns off that. But the problem is, she's not an active grappler after the fight does hit the floor. And there are some fighters who can make use of just sitting in a full guard, sitting in a half guard, and they can really damage their opponents. Weird example, but Mirko Krokop, the second time he fought Gabriel Gonzaga, he stayed in his full guard and elbowed him into the ground. It was like some disgusting stuff. If you're a really high-level striker, normally those skills do kind of translate to your ground and pound. I know it sounds weird because ground and pound is much more kind of a grappling part of your game, but a lot of high-level strikers still have good ground and pound. Jessica Rose Clark, again, not a high-level striker, but you get the idea. She doesn't really have those parts of her game to really make fighters pay for being underneath her. And that's always the hard part about predicting one of her fights. You could think, hey, she's going to go 3-for-3 with her takedowns and get about 8 minutes of control time. But is she going to do enough with those 8 minutes of control time to really be able to secure those rounds in the minds of judges? Some judges, yes, but others not so much. And that's why I always find it really hard breaking down a fight of Jessica Rose Clark.
Yeah, because for Clark, she'll throw a good 1-2. Does she throw the most leg kicks that you've seen in this division? Not necessarily. She utilizes her wrestling, but kind of like a TJ Brown, Jessica Rose Clark can get herself in some really precarious positions on the ground. That happened in her last fight against Stephanie Egger. She loses that fight by armbar, Matt. Then we throw it on over to Yulia Stoyanenko, and this is really the big talking point. Because, Matt, I'm going to talk about Stoyanenko's career highlight. She was featured on The Ultimate Fighter. She went 1-1 and lost to the eventual finalist, Penny Kanza.
It's like an Anthony Bennett highlight reel.
The UFC said, Red Rover, send Yulia over. Let's give her a real fight in the UFC. She loses to Leah Letson, so they go, okay, we don't need none of you. So what does Yulia do? Well, she picks up a tidy little win streak outside of the promotion. She goes, hey, let's get some Art of the Nine Limb, experience, and I'm going to fight Lethwei a little bit. And she wins. She is a champion in Lethwei. She is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And Matt, though she did go 5-0 outside of the UFC from 2019 to 2020, she fought once in 2020, she lost. She fought once in 2021, she lost. She fought once in 2022, she lost. So, I don't know, -1.52 strike differential, but this is the craziest part about Yulia Stoyanenko. Is she necessarily like Ronda Rousey at the height of her powers? No. But for Yulia, all of her wins by submission are by armbar. And you watch the way that Stoyanenko fights, and we can really break it down technique for technique. Like, Stoyanenko strikes like a car crash, and I watch her fight, and I look at Vanessa Demopoulos from last weekend, and it's like, okay, in your set positions on the ground, you're a great grappler in that respect. When it comes to the striking, it's a little odd. I mean, she does train Muay Thai. She's trained over in Oslo, Norway for this fight, working at Frontline Academy. We've seen her with Hodger Gracie working some of these things here and there. But for Stoyanenko, her bread gets buttered when she has her back to the mat and she's looking for those submissions, looking for that armbar. You look at her against Alexis Davis in her last fight. Davis beat her soundly. But in that first round, Yulia Stoyanenko went for 2 or 3 of the tightest armbars I've ever seen. And Gumby Davis, just doing Niagara Falls stuff, was able to get out of those. But Matt, most people would have tapped out of that. I find it crazy that Yulia Stoyanenko on a 3-fight losing streak like this is still in the promotion.
So am I.
But further to that, again, she has those pieces of her game that the UFC's keeping her around. She's outside of the top 15, and Jessica Rose Clark can struggle in some of those positions.
She can, but she also has a lot of positives in those positions, too. Like, for Stolyarenko, she's going to waste a lot of time off her back. We talked about this with Loey Smolka for years and years and years and years and years and years, performance after performance. And that's what I worry about with Stolyarenko. Unless she does get the finish by some kind of submission, I don't think she has really any component of her game to be able to win rounds. And again, I know a big part of my talking point on Jessica Rose Clark was, hey, she could really get the takedown and then that's it. I would still much rather side with the fighter that I think can get it to the spaces where they want the fight to be, as opposed to a fighter who's just going to take the fight where the positions come, and she'll try to fight her way out of that. And again, it's not that I'm really confident in Jessica Rose Clark, and she is a fighter who I feel like after her ACL injury doesn't really fight in the same manner that she used to. She used to be a little bit more aggressive. She used to be a little bit more explosive with her takedowns. I don't think she has that same kind of level of athleticism behind a lot of her techniques, but I still think it's going to be enough to beat Stolyarenko, who in the UFC up until this point has not been able to show that much. I understand some of those submission attempts were tight on Davis, but Alexis Davis is a 39-year-old fighter in this division. If they were that tight, she would have tapped out to it, and I know she's got heart for days, but again, I do think Jessica Rose Clark fights in a similar manner to Alexis Davis, and unless she does get caught by one of those submissions, she's much more likely to be able to pick up minutes and rounds throughout this fight.
And for Jessica Rose Clark, if she's going to capitalize on the Alexis Davis plan, Gumby arms and knee wraps. Judo Dan knee wraps, goodness. That's how you win it. That's how Davis is able to do it. When you do look at Rose Clark, again, she had those two big wins, 2020, 2021, against Sarah Alper and Jocelyn Edwards, but her last time out, the wrestling got her caught against a great judo player and great jiu-jitsu player in, of course, Stephanie Edgar. So we look at the odds for this one. I don't know who decided that Yulia Stoyanenko should have been a minus 205 at open. That's what Best Fight Odds shows. Now, it corrected itself quite quickly, so I'm sure we'll hear from some people out in the comments section. Plus 112 right now for Clark, opened at a plus 175, minus 135. So we have a look at the Tapology votes. Matt, surprise to us there to you. Jessica Rose Clark, A, now the favorite. B, more people know her, and she's not on a 3-fight losing streak. I'm going to say over under 75% Clark here.
I don't think she's that famous. I think it'll be lower, but she'll be the favorite.
Okay, 775 total votes, 92% Clark, 90% by decision for the 8% that have Stoyarenko, 49% by decision, 38% have her to win by submission. So Matt, the fans, 92% of them have Clark. The you know, odds have Clark as well as the pick here, Jessica Rose Clark.
It is, and again, I'm not confident with this fight whatsoever. Like you said, if a fighter starts as a minus 200 favorite and then the line adjusts itself in like 30 minutes, you know something's a little off about this fight. But again, I always go back to this. Think about how both fighters fight. I would much rather Jessica Rose Clark put herself in a bad position by trying to fight to win than Yulia Stolyarenko just allowing herself to be put in poor positions and then trying to fight her way out of it. Again, stylistically, Stolyarenko does have some of the jiu-jitsu that Jessica Rose Clark does traditionally struggle with. I just don't think she can use it sustainably throughout her fighting style. So I do think Jessica Rose Clark, by the slimmest of margins, can win a decision. But again, this is a fighter who had a pretty close fight with Jessica Ai years ago. And you would think, okay, you're a younger prospect. You had a close fight with someone who's very established in this division. I still feel like Jessica Rose Clark ever really reached the potential that a lot of people saw for her. But I still think she'll be able to get this win.
Clark, for this one, training at Combat Sports Academy with Dakota Dichteva, who's a mixed martial artist. She's got some Muay Thai kickboxing in her back pocket. Adam Piccolotti, Bellator Zone, and Chad Mendes. Thick boy Chad Mendes.
The scariest man you could fight in bare knuckle right now.
He's entered into the chat. And if you do look at it for Clark, she just competed in a no-gi grappling tournament with Grappling Industries. I think it was her and Amber Laybrock in the picture. But I like the underdog, Yulia Stoyarenko. I didn't like her at minus 200, but at a plus 112, why not take a flyer? Some of these underdogs have been winning early on in these cards with unranked women's fighters. We saw it out of Vanessa Demopoulos last week. We even saw it the week before with Silva against Jazz Avizius. And it's not that it's a trend, but for me, I look at it as, who has the opportunity to stop this fight? Jessica Rose Clark's boxing looked amazing against Sarah Alper. Her cage control is amazing in that fight. In the smaller octagon, larger one for this fight, Stoyarenko with the submission abilities. I've justified it in my mind. But again, it's a close fight between two unranked women's bantamweights, and there's only four other ones that exist on the face of this planet. So make a judgment on your own. We're split on the pick. I've got Lithuania's Stoyarenko. Matt going with Australia's Rose Clark. It's not Rose Clark. It's Jessica Rose Clark. Jessica
I didn't
Rose
do it once.
And
you
Clark.
Did.
Matt, pats for Matt. But a big time fight coming up this weekend. Two title fights up at the tops. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Like Linus found out in the Charlie Brown series, he was waiting for the Great Pumpkin. We got the Great Pumpkin. It's Brad Tavares's yearly turn at fighting. We get a fight between the ranked middleweight Brad Tavares taking on Still Knox, the former EFC double champ and KSW champ Dricus du Plessis. And for Brad Tavares, it has been a wild, and I'm talking wild, UFC career that he has had. I can talk about the knockouts. There's only a few. I can talk about the decisions. There's a lot of them, but primarily a guy that's going out there and doing similar things in the majority of his fights. He's a guy that's trained out of Extreme Couture for years and years and years. But when you look at it for Brad Tavares, a 14-6 UFC record, he's tied for second all-time in decision wins behind Neil Magny. Wasn't able to get another decision win last weekend. Shavkat Rakhmonov.
That's one of those stats you hear, though, and it makes perfect sense. You don't hear that, and you're like, wait, Neil Magny has that many decisions? So no, that stat makes perfect sense to me.
But for Brad Tavares, he made his UFC debut in 2010 following an appearance on The Ultimate Fighter 11. He was what? 23 years old, like a fresh-faced guy, and he went out there and had some wild fights. I mean, Court McGee won that season of The Ultimate Fighter. He's still kicking it, but he is a few years older. For Brad Tavares, goes out there, has some back-and-forth fights. I mean, I go back to the fight he had against Phil Baroni, and Phil cleans his clock, and then Brad gets back up, and Brad beats Phil Baroni, beats him pretty handily up against the mat, and then down against the cage, and you know how it goes. But for Tavares, primarily a guy, we touched on this before we even started to film, but really, really thunderous leg kicks, and he was one of those guys that brought leg kicks into his game before it was popular, and it was a talking point every single weekend. So for Tavares, he was able to ride home on that fact. He was able to become a ranked fighter with that. I'd say his biggest wins probably over who? Christophe Jotko, when he finished him? Like,
no.
Talis Laitis, maybe? What would you say? Here's the weird thing about Brad Tavares, and this is my whole entire point. When was the last time Brad Tavares won a fight you thought he wasn't supposed to? He beats everybody he's supposed to beat and loses to everybody he's supposed to lose to. And that's the weird part about being Brad Tavares at this point in his career.
Being Brad Tavares.
We talk about Neil Magny, how he's a gatekeeper. We talk about Derek Brunson, how he's a gatekeeper. Brad Tavares is a gatekeeper too, but he's a gatekeeper who's lower down in the division. So the problem is, a lot of guys do tend to get through this gate. And that's the thing about Brad Tavares. I don't have the mouse in front of me, if you don't mind pulling up his record. But if you go back and look at the recent amount of wins and losses that he has, a lot of his wins are over aging guys who he's expected to win. Guys like Antonio Carlos Jr., who is on his way out of the organization. Omari Akhmedov, the exact same thing. Christophe Jotko, I guess there was some hype behind him, but even then, he wasn't really at the peak of his powers. Talis Laitis was very old in his career.
Talis Laitis was 36 at that point and took so much damage. He got dropped by a leg kick. His eye on the left side was completely done. And the Elias Theodoro fight was actually kind of close.
So Talis Laitis got dropped by a leg kick and got destroyed. And the Elias Theodoro fight, not really. But that's the thing about Brad Tavares. The Cal Magalhaes fight was pretty close too, but that's the thing with Brad. None of his fights are that. There's not a big separation between him and his opponents because he's not a natural puncher. Even go back to some of the previous losses. Lost to Yoel, Tim Boach, yikes, and Robert Whittaker. Yoel, Robert Whittaker, there's no shame in that whatsoever. Israel Adesanya too, but you get what I mean when I'm talking about his record. Every single person who you thought has some hype and they're on their way into the rankings, they kind of mopped the floor with Brad Tavares. And even like Edmund Shabazian, a guy who had a lot of hype before he got into the rankings, then he fought guys in the rankings, and we kind of realized how good he was able to get past Brad Tavares. I don't think Dricus du Plessis is some world beater by any means. I think he's one of those great fighters who he has a lot of power, he has an exciting style, and on his best day, I think he'd be like that 13th to 15th ranked guy. I just think he's not the fastest guy in the world with his hands, so he might get into a little bit of trouble against the higher ranked fighters. But against Brad Tavares, I think he has an answer for every single question Brad Tavares brings to this fight, like you talk about. He has a good leg kick. Well, Dricus du Plessis does have a pretty light lead leg. He's someone who almost will shell up prematurely. It is kind of weird. He'll almost think the punch is coming before it's supposed to, which is a little weird. And that's the only reason why I think the odds are where they are. And that's kind of what I'll end on. I was surprised to see that Dricus du Plessis was a slight underdog. I understand the odds are almost par, and I do expect them to be par by the time this fight comes around. But I felt like du Plessis would have a lot more hype coming into this matchup with Tavares.
I did a ton of tape study for these fights coming up this weekend, more than I usually ever do. And when it came to this one, I looked at Brad Tavares and I had this idea of Tavares in my mind's eye.
A lot of leg kicks, a lot of 1-2 boxing combinations. He's got a great right hand, and he's speedy for what you think of, you know, Brad Tavares, or at least he was speedier than I had this image of him.
Did you think he was bad at 5,000 before?
But again, for Brad Tavares, 14-6 in the UFC, how many pay-per-view cards, if you had to hazard a guess, how many pay-per-view cards do you think Brad Tavares has been on in 20 UFC fights?
4.
8! He's been on 8 pay-per-view cards. Like, Brad Tavares, bring home the bacon, baby. Let's put Brad on that card. For Du Plessis, this is the thing. I mean, he kind of got his foray and his entry into MMA from kickboxing. He was a 2012 champ, and I want to make sure I get it right. WAKO 2012, first place in the 86 kg category as a junior. So he gets into that, gets into MMA. He's got an early loss to Gareth McLennan, you know, a guy who was in the UFC at one point. But for Dricus, he was the EFC welterweight champ, the EFC middleweight champ. He goes over to KSW, wins that welterweight strap. He has the crazy fights with Roberto Soldic, a guy who, if he came into the UFC, if you like Dricus Du Plessis, if you like Mateusz Gamrot, whether you thought he won or not, I don't care. Roberto Soldic is that guy. Like, he is a wild, wild fighter.
USADA.
So for Dricus, I don't know about that, allegedly. But when I do look at Dricus, beats Joelton Lutterbach after losing to Soldic, beats Brandon Lesser over at the UFC to win back the middleweight strap, comes into the UFC, wild fight against Marcus Perez, beats him, great fight against Trevin Giles where he drops him with, like, just that Trevin's hands are low. We're going to drop him with a straight punch. And it was kind of a bit of an odd one. But when I look at the strikes for Du Plessis, if you think that he's rigid or maybe he's a little nervous in the Perez fight, 26-14 for significant strikes that favored Du Plessis in that first fight. In the second one against Giles, 25-10. And for Du Plessis, throws great kicks. He can throw body, head. He can mix it up. Good leg kicks. Really good boxing combinations. Really crisp with those. Very accurate striker. But my biggest knock on Stilnox when it came to his way into the UFC, it's his takedown defense. And that's the thing. When I think of Brad Tavares, I think of, okay, WrestleBoxer, Extreme Tour, in my mind's eye. Brad Tavares doesn't shoot that many takedowns, though. That's the thing. Like, Brad Tavares isn't big with it. He has good takedown defense, and he can force the action up against the fence, but he isn't the most active guy going for takedowns. So it would surprise me if he did that against Du Plessis. It really would. And again, for Tavares, he was able to take down Seth Baczynski. He's able to take down Donggi Yang. But, like, I'm going way back into the past. 2 against Lorenz Larkin. But it's not really a trend that's picked up lately. Omari Akhmedov almost won the fight against Tavares after Tavares dropped Omari Akhmedov because Akhmedov was going for the takedowns. The fight against Antonio Carlos Jr. was closer than it needed to be.
He beat the brakes off Antonio Carlos Jr.
But again, you'd think a guy like Brad Tavares in the rankings would mop Shoeface, but he didn't. But when it comes to the odds for this fight, Matt, Tavares open to -130 favorite, -103 right now. Du Plessis open +110, -113 as it stands. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% for Du Plessis.
Under.
I'm going to say it's under. It's over. So 824 total votes, 82% Du Plessis, 79% by knockout for the 18% that have Tavares, 71% by decision, and 18% that I have him to win by knockout. So Matt, again, kind of tipped our hand on this one, but what's the pick here?
I'm just really confused by Brad Tavares, the favorite in this fight, if I'm being completely honest with everybody. Again, Brad Tavares tends to lose to the upper echelon tier of prospects in this division, and I don't think Du Plessis is going to go on and just run through the rankings, but I think he's good enough to beat a couple guys in the rankings. And for Tavares, most of his fights come down to, can I not get knocked out? And does my opponent not throw a crazy amount of volume? Because if you are a heavy-handed striker, you will eventually get to Brad Tavares. And the other side of that is, if you're not a heavy-handed striker, but you have a lot of volume, you can also beat Brad Tavares in a fight like that. So unless he's in a fight where he's against, like, almost like a jiu-jitsu fighter who has okay hands and poor wrestling, those are the types of guys who make Brad Tavares look really good. Pure strikers, for the most part, are able to outwork Brad Tavares on the feet. And like you said, you would look at his camp, look at the amount of experience he's had in the UFC, and think, hey, this guy has some wrestling in his back pocket. But if you don't do it in the cage, I don't think all of a sudden we're going to see it just magically in your, what, 21st fight in the UFC. So for Brad Tavares, unless he is something that we never thought he was up until this weekend, I do like Dricus Du Plessis in this matchup. And again, I don't love his just sort of awkwardness in the pocket, for lack of a better term, yeah, because it is kind of weird to see. And I do think the Chris Curtis fight, which hopefully they do revisit that in the near future.
Yeah, so the Du Plessis point that I just wanted to make, he was booked in the interim since his last fight because he's been in the UFC for almost 2 years. He's only had 2 fights. He was booked with Andrea Muniz, Chris Curtis, Hernandez, and Gaslam, and that Gaslam fight was the last one that fell out.
The Chris Curtis fight would be a really fun one. Hopefully we do get that, especially with Curtis coming off the win over Rodolfo Vieira, and especially against Duplessis. I think that'd be a great fight. But for Dricus, this is an interesting fight because I think it will go late. But I still have him winning this fight. I just think technically he's a much more sound fighter than the striker that Brad Tavares presents in the majority of his fights.
In 20 UFC fights, Brad Tavares has 4 knockdowns. 3 of those 4 knockdowns are in the third round of fights. The Phil Baroni one was the only one that he got in the first round.
2 of them came 11 years apart, though. And it went from Phil Baroni to Christoph Jocko. I went from grade 6 to last year.
Talis Laetes, actually. 2017 was the next one.
Isn't that wild? Like, 7 years. You're a middleweight. If you're a flyweight, I get it. There's a lot of decisions down there. But in the middleweight division, it is very surprising to see a guy go years without getting a stoppage victory. Maybe he will sit down on his shots against Duplessis when he is shelled up against the cage. But if Duplessis is able to respond with his own power shots, I think he'll land.
If I'm going Tavares non-controversially, I'd say Tavares by decision. For me, though, I do like Dricus Duplessis in this matchup. I think the volume is the key for Duplessis, and he throws in droves. And yes, through that high guard of Tavares, maybe Duplessis is able to mix it into the body, but I can't wait for this fight. Both of us going with South Africa's. Still knocks Duplessis to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. We have a big time title fight at the top of this card in this division. Brad Tavares fought Israel Adesanya, wasn't able to get the win. We'll see if Jared Cannonier can do it for that belt. You're gonna want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. This weekend, the first of 2 nicknames being the future, we have Macy the Future Barber taking on Evil Jessica Eye. Jessica Evil Eye, do you think on the internet she goes, look at my evil eye? I hope not. Remember that time she did get cut in the forehead, though? That was gross.
I always go back to, I'm gonna need everyone in here to do this chant for me. Here we go, evil, here we go, hoo, hoo. And then not a soul in the building did it.
Jessica I, ladies and gentlemen. But when it comes to nicknames, again, for the future Macy Barber, she was going to be the future. She was going to be the youngest UFC champ. The time has passed. Ian Garry is the second fighter on this card that is the future as a nickname. Changed them. But when it does come to this matchup, it was actually originally supposed to be Jessica I against Casey O'Neill because, listen, the UFC wants their top prospects to take on Jessica I. Unfortunately for Casey O'Neill, she had a knee injury. So in steps Macy Barber on a 2-fight winning streak. And if you look at the Barber hype train and the way that it went, at a time she was 8-0. She fought Roxanne Modafferi. She blew out her own knee. And she really wasn't successful in that fight. Took some time off, rehabbed it, moved around between gyms, came back and fight Alexa Grasso. And that was a fun enough fight, wasn't it? Would you say?
It was a tough fight for her, to be honest. Especially back after a long layoff. Fighting a volume-oriented striker who relies on their movement is a weird opponent to give somebody fresh off a knee injury. Because if you're thinking, hey, Macy Barber could be a star in the future, she might have trouble moving around with a poor knee, who should we give her? Well, not someone who just strikes on the back foot the whole time, but the Grasso fight was a fun one.
So we look at that. She loses that fight. She comes back and fights Miranda Maverick. It's a win on her record. It's a win going forward. And then if you look at her last fight, she fought Montana De La Rosa, a fight that you would almost anticipate Macy Barber was going to win. She passed that test with flying colors. So that's a good stepping stone to then get to Jessica I. And listen, Jessica I's had a weird UFC career, Matt. I never would have thought, looking through it, you know, you think Jessica Eye, you think ranked contender, 135, 125. She's 5-9 in the UFC with no contest. Like, I would have thought.
Oh, I know. Because she lost 5 straight at 135. She was like Anthony Freight Train Hamilton of women's bantamweight.
Freight Train. The Pacific Northwest zone. He just can't get any love on
the
channel.
I can't believe he just caught another straight. But that's the thing. Like, I gotta be honest. I was the one who was surprised Jessica Eye had success at 125. She was an awful fighter at 135. And I don't feel like that's a step too far at all. She lost to Betch Kohea.
Betch
fought for a UFC title. Rally. But it depends on what UFC division you fought for that title. If you fight for the lightweight title in the men's division, I put a lot of stock into that. She probably had to beat 7 of the best fighters we've ever seen just to get that opportunity. Jessica I won 3 fights by split decision and then fought Valentina Shevchenko. It went exactly how we all thought it would go, and ever since, I has kind of gone back into some of those poor habits that she showed before. It is interesting because she fought Araujo, who a lot of people had a lot of hype into. She's a very heavy-handed striker herself, and Jessica was able to beat her. But the thing was, I didn't get better after the Valentina fight. She just did what she's always done. It's frustrating boxing to where she throws a lot of volume, and it's one of those weird, do I block it? Do I not worry about it because there's not a lot of power? Because for Jessica Eye, people love talking about her boxing. Oh, she's such a good boxer. She's such a good boxer. Not really. Like, she throws looping shots, but the thing is, if you are a very heavy-handed striker, you can get a respect almost immediately, because in most of the areas she's going to have success, it makes her hittable too. So let's say Jessica Eye comes into this fight like she comes into most. I'm going to try to get into a brawl. I'm going to try to make it ugly. I don't think Macy Barber's the best fighter in the world, but she's a whole hell of a lot heavier-handed than Jessica Eye is. So if they just get into, like, one of these all-time, just Dawn Fry type of fights, I think Macy Barber beats the brakes off Jessica Eye.
You're telling me International Fight Week isn't the time to break out the here-we-go evil?
Well, just, if you wear a bulletproof vest before you fight Valentina Shevchenko, you better go on to do, like, really cool things for the rest of your life. You shouldn't lose three of your next four and have us wondering what you're doing. And last thing I will say on this fight reminds me of when Kemba Walker got taken out of the Boston Celtics rotation. Just all of a sudden, it was, hey, you were an all-star with the Celtics. Hey, you're not as good anymore. Your knee might be bad. We don't really know. And for Jessica, it was, okay, you were an all-star. You fought for a title. You must be very good. Eh, are you? This the last step for I. If she's not able to beat Macy Barber, and if she does go on a four-fight losing streak, especially at this stage of her career, I don't expect her to stay around for that much longer. But the flip side is, this is a really important fight for Macy Barber because she has had a lot of oh-by-the-ways throughout her career. Even her losses, they're sort of weird. She had the injury, and then she fought a really good fighter coming back. But I thought she looked really good in the Montana De La Rosa fight. It got some of the bad taste out of my mouth from her previous three performances. So I do feel like Macy Barber is slightly on the come-up, whereas Jessica Eye seems to be going downhill.
Yeah, and I look at Eye after the win over Araujo. She got run over by Cynthia Calvillo in a five-round fight. It was one of the oddest main events. It happened. Calvillo took her down at, well, Calvillo beat her in every single position.
She and goes how good has Calvillo looked? Not great
not
since
good,
that.
But still, I mean,
but that's
shiny,
my whole point.
That girl is nasty.
But if you lose that bad to her, who's quitting two fights, then...
The Joanne Wood fight was a little odd. She just didn't really have her timing there. She fights Jennifer Maia about a year ago. She didn't win that fight. Okay, Joanne Calderwood ended up fighting. Like, the Jennifer Maias, the Joanne Calderwoods, we're still talking about the upper echelon of this division, which is saying something. But the weirdest thing for me for Jessica Eye was she left Strong Style. It was a big talking point. She went down to Vegas. She had success, lightning in a bottle. Before the Manon Fiorot fight that was supposed to happen earlier on this year, Jessica Eye moved from Vegas back up to Ohio with Strong Style. It was supposed to be like a feel-good comeback story. That fight didn't happen. She was booked against Andrea Leaf. That fight didn't happen. You go to her Instagram now, she's training at Strong Style still. So working that boxing, I expect a typical Jessica Eye game plan of good volume, good cardio. She'll be there in that third round, and we'll see what happens. For Macy Barber, though, clinch work, dirty boxing, oddities up against the cage behind the black line, takedown city, and I think Barber's going to have a lot of success because Barber's one of those fighters that, like I said, she's bounced around gym to gym. It was Valley Flow striking for a bit. It's been Team Alpha Male for a bit. I think you pick up pieces, and I know Team Alpha Male, when you look at just singularly one fighter like a Holly and Pivey, you go, wow. Why couldn't he do any of the wrestling? Well, he tried in his last fight, but both guys got tired and had a hell of a fight. I think for Macy Barber, though, her game is rooted in being not just so one-dimensional, mixing things up. So I look at the odds here. I open a plus 135 underdog, plus 185 right now. Barber open a minus 155, minus 230 as it stands. We have a look at the votes on Tapology. Surprised as they are to you, but I bet they aren't. I'm going to say over-under 85% Barber.
I was going to say 90, so.
I'm not being nice with these, but I'm being frank. 787 is the vote total. 92% Barber, 87% by decision. For the 8% that have I, 74% by decision. Here we go, evil. Here we go. Who let the dogs out? I don't think she's going to win.
Barber's going to try to win, and that means a lot. I know that's a weird thing to say. Oh, everybody's trying to win when they're in the cage. But I talk about this when we talk about Joanne Wood, all the time. Joanne Wood's perfect fight plan is basically to win a split decision. It's I'm going to get the fight and do a lot of kind of 50-50 spots. I'm going to hope that I land these slightly more damaging shots, and then hopefully the judges give it to me at the end of the whole thing. Like, win, lose, or draw, most Wood fights end in split decision. For Jessica Eye, she does follow a lot of that same philosophy. It's, hey, I'm going to get into exchanges. I might be landing, but I'm also going to get hit too. And the problem is, when you're fighting people like Manafialo, who she didn't fight, but that was a matchup that we thought we were going to see, Macy Barber, who's extremely heavy-handed, I'll throw Jessica Andrade into that category because she's kind of a tweener between this division and strawweight. I think that's an awful style to have. And the thing is, if you automatically found out that Jessica I, almost at her 36th birthday, was on a 4-fight losing streak, like, that would make sense. This isn't unheard of. She is quite old in her career, so I do expect Macy Barber to get the win.
And if you do think that, hey, Jessica I, her second-to-last win was over Caitlin Chookagian, you'd be right, and those are facts. Both of us in this matchup going with the future. That's just the nickname. Macy Barber to get the win. The future, Ian Garry's taking on Gabe Green. That's a fight that I'm excited about. We have some big-time fights left on this card, including the two title fights at the tops. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Fight Night Picks fans, coming up this weekend in the main event, we have a middleweight title fight. Israel Adesanya taking on Jared Cannonier on that main card. Sean Strickland taking on Alex Pereira. But down in the prelims, this fight has pay-per-view feels. We have primetime Uriah Hall taking on Sergio Pano, Andrea Muniz, and I absolutely love this clash of styles. When you look at this fight, Andrea Muniz, is he one of the best grapplers in this division? Well, he took that crown and took Jacare Souza's arm home with him. And if you look at that 2021 submission of the year, when you look at it for Uriah Hall, this guy was on the tidiest win streak maybe of his career. And he came into the UFC off of the Ultimate Fighter season 17, split decision loss to Kelvin Gastelum. This will be his eighth pay-per-view fight. And if I took Uriah Hall's wins and I stacked them up and I threw them on a board, Hall of Fame level wins. Thiago Santos. He's got Gegard Mousasi up there. He also has Chris Weidman and Anderson Silva. Like, those are all-timers that Uriah Hall has actually beaten his career. Some of the losses, you scratch your head, and I would too.
Wait, is Uriah Hall the Dante Bichette of UFC? Because here's the thing. If you look at Dante Bichette's stats,
he's like... Burt Blylevin was the example I used the other week.
But Dante Bichette has a war of six. But he has 370 career home runs. That makes no sense whatsoever. The problem was, he played like the steroid era and in the sky, basically, in Colorado. So a lot of that is held against him. Whereas for Uriah Hall, like you said, the highs are very high. If you just look at the wins, you're like, wow, this guy probably held the title at some point through his career. Not really, though, because a lot of those wins are at different stages of those fighters' careers. For Thiago Santos, very early in his career when Uriah Hall was able to beat him. But I always go back to the Olawale Bamboje win, because for some reason, Olawale had a lot of hype behind him, and Uriah Hall beat the absolute brakes off of him.
So did Charlie Ward.
Yeah, poor Charlie Ward. But in that fight, Uriah Hall just took him down, looked really good, and then that set him up for the Gegard Mousasi fight, and that was a very exciting fight. And it was a weird part of Uriah Hall's career, too, because Uriah Hall was looked at as the next sort of, I don't know, like Anderson Silva, basically. I know that's wild to say, but coming off the Ultimate Fighter, people were like, okay, he might have to fight for the title. He's so good coming off of this show, because he was destroying everybody. Then, of course, he loses to Kelvin Gastelum in a very close fight in the main event, but still, that was the type of hype that Uriah Hall had coming off of that show, whereas now you can win the Ultimate Fighter, walk into my apartment, and I probably don't know who you are, just because the Ultimate Fighter has fallen off quite a bit, but back in the day, a very hyped up show. Uriah Hall's never really realized the full potential at all, if we're being completely honest, but still, the highs are extremely high because of how much of a specialist he is on the feet. His striking, just strike for strike, is as good as anybody's, but the weird thing about Uriah Hall is, you have all this power, you have all this flashiness, but he never really lets his hands go, and that's always been the weird part of his career. It's like, hey, I'm a martial artist, I don't like hurting guys, I'm more of like the classic, like, karate bow and be respectful. Then you look at his highlight reel and you're like, wow, none of that was respectful whatsoever. It's just weird that you're so violent when you let your hands go, but your one X factor is, I don't really like letting my hands go.
And when you look at Uriah Hall's overall body of work, and trust me, we're going to talk about both guys, compare and contrast, but I go back and I look at the loss that he had to Paulo Costa, where he kind of gets Costa to drop the one knee, and then Costa comes right back, fires away, and looks great in that one. So what does Uriah Hall do? Well, a few months later, he takes on Bavon Lewis. And he loses the first two rounds and into the third round of that fight. And then he knocks out Bavon Lewis. And it's like, oh, okay. Uriah's back. Then he takes on Antonio Carlos Jr. And I made a mistake earlier on in the show. I conflated Brad Tavares' fight against Shoeface to Uriah Hall's fight against Shoeface. Because when Uriah Hall fought Shoeface, he did get taken down in that fight.
The nicest non-knockout punch I've ever seen in my life.
But when it came to the striking, Uriah Hall had a lot of success. So that's my bad. He fights Anderson Silva, and it's like, wow, this is Uriah Hall in that fight. He's able to get the win in that one. They have the weird ending where I think Anderson was trying to have his, like, I'm done with the UFC. Like, it's sad. And then Uriah Hall was like, but I respect you. You're my idol. So I got to get in on this. It was weird. It was sweet. It was what it was. And then he fought Chris Weidman. Checked a leg kick, broke Chris's leg, and it was like, well, that's disgusting. He fights Sean Strickland. Now, in that fight, Saif Saud is yelling at him and pleading with him to get moving, and it doesn't happen. The scorecards in that one, 50-44, 50-45, 49-46. It was one of Uriah Hall's worst performances off a four-fight win streak where it was finally like, Uriah's got it. We're going. We're back. Old Gil's out there.
Wait, you thought he was back after beating a 50-year-old Anderson Silva and having Chris Weidman wrap his leg around his?
It's better than losing fights.
I don't know many people who were that excited about Uriah Hall into the Sean Strickland fight thinking he was going to fight for the title, though. Like, I thought he was going to beat Sean Strickland, but I didn't think it was like, wow, this guy's back. Because that's the thing. If you look at the guys who he's beat, Bavon Lewis, one of the worst prospects in UFC history, that's aggressive, but still. Bavon Lewis had like a lot of hype behind him coming into this organization. Did not look great. Antonio Carlos Jr., where again, he lands the nicest non-knockout punch of my life. He drops him. He like steps through Antonio Carlos Jr. and punches 7 inches behind him. It's one of the nicest shots you'll ever see. And again, him knocking out an old Anderson where he had trouble with him early because he wasn't letting his hands go. That's the big thing with Uriah Hall. If he fights anybody who throws a lot of volume, they're going to win rounds from him. And that's and yes, he might be able to land that one crippling shot later on in the fight because he is such a cerebral striker. But the problem is, he's not very durable. He doesn't have the best gas tank we've ever seen. And if he gets hit to the body, this is the thing about Uriah Hall. He does have a little, like, looking for a way out when the fight gets really tough.
Oh, come on.
I'm going to stick with it. How did Paulo Costa beat him? He drops Paulo Costa. Paulo Costa gets in his face, goes to his body, throws combinations, makes the fight hard on him, and then he melts as a result of it. That's been the thing about Uriah Hall. If the fight's going well for him, he can keep on looking good. But once the going gets really hard, I don't often look at Uriah Hall as being a guy who's going to get past that. Now, against Christophe Jaco, he was able to do that. He looked really bad early on and got past it. But we're talking about Christophe Jaco here, and right now he's fighting Andre Muniz, who, yes, doesn't play the striking game, but he's one of the most hyped up prospects we've had in a very long time. And even me, I didn't think Andre Muniz coming into the UFC would have the same level of success that he had before. How am I supposed to know what's in your notes? But the thing is, once he got to the UFC, had beautiful wins over the likes of Bartosz Stravinsky and then Jacare Souza, like, now I think we are seeing him finally put everything together in his game. And much like Gilbert Burns down at welterweight, once you see these guys who specialize in really anything able to start putting their whole entire games together, that's when they become dangerous and make their run in the rankings.
First thing in my notes, I have Muniz, and right next to it, wasn't convinced pre-UFC, and that's the thing. I just wasn't. Obviously, this guy's a great grappler, but if you look at it, 22-4 as of now, those four losses are all by knockout. And you look at it, I mean, Azamat Mirzakhanov was his last loss, lost by knockout, of course, in 2016. Azamat Mirzakhanov has a fight coming up in August against Devin Clark. He just knocked out Tafan Chukwe, which is what it is. But if you do look at it for Andre Muniz, he does beat Antonio Arroyo. He's able to take him down, control some of the positions, beats Bartosz Babinski because Bartosz is going to wrestle himself into awful positions.
Bad
because
idea.
He's just a judo man. He never learned jiu-jitsu. He beat Jacare Souza with 2021's submission of the year, and he beat Eric Anders his last time out in December, and that's a fight that I want to look at. Now, I should mention that this fight was originally booked between Uriah Hall and Andre Muniz for April on a fight night card. Uriah Hall withdrew, and so they rebooked it to later on in July. So it's been a while since it was booked originally. But in that Eric Anders fight, Anders is trying to throw the kitchen sink at Andre Muniz. And as he's getting wild and as Anders is marching forward with his arms up, Andre Muniz lands a double leg, like edge landing a spear in WWE in 2007. He then just wrestles around for position, goes from top to the back, and once he gets the back, then he sneaks over to the side, and the commentary says, he's too high on this, he can't get the rear naked choke. Well, then he turns it into an armbar. The guy is a wizard on the ground. He's a third-degree black belt in jiu-jitsu from Otavio Duarte, so if you're gonna tell your friends something at Buffalo Wild Wings this weekend, go with that one. But 4-0 in the UFC is Muniz. 15 of his 22 wins are by submission. Again, 11 of them are in the first round. I'd say his best win on his record, either Jacare or Matt's favorite middleweight from yesteryear, Paulo Filho. He was able to beat him in a title fight with Bledi Combat back in 2014, his lone title defense there. But again, there are so many positives to talk about for Uriah Hall with striking, his takedown defense, iffy, and Sean Strickland in the later rounds of that five-round fight was able to work in his takedowns.
But this is my whole thing going back to when you make the fight hard on Uriah Hall, he doesn't always get hard with it. Like, against Sean Strickland, you were convincingly down three rounds. Did Uriah Hall do anything different in the last two to try to win?
It's hard. It's hard.
Well, no, he did. That's my whole point. It's hard. You're in the main event of a UFC show. We expect you to do hard things to try to get the wins. That's my problem with Uriah Hall. If he's behind in a fight, he might land that one crazy shot that's going to win it for him. But if you swing big at every pinch, eventually you're going to hit one over the fence. If you're not able to land that one big shot, Uriah Hall's going to lose a fight by decision in a very lopsided manner.
Matt Allen, if the going gets hard, you get hard too. Put that on a Bristol board. Matt, the odds for this fight, Uriah Hall open a plus 190 underdog, plus 206 right now. Andrea Muniz open a minus 225, minus 258 as it stands. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Muniz.
Over.
Yeah, it's been over a lot for these favorites. 855 total votes, 86% Muniz, 85% by submission, with 14% that have Hall, 54% by knockout. I'm surprised that number is not higher, considering Muniz has only ever lost by knockout, and Uriah Hall is such a power puncher. I think Andrea Muniz goes out there and has a lot of success with his takedowns. Uriah Hall coming from a great gym with a lot of great grapplers at Fortis MMA. But a lot of the bigger fighters aren't great grapplers there, like Alonzo Menafield, Kenny Inchekwu. We're not talking about big-time grapplers at that gym. And Hall is very much a specialist when it comes to his striking. So unless Hall is able to knock out Muniz, I have Muniz winning, and I think he'll get it done by submission.
And I think he's been looking a lot more comfortable on the feet, too. I'm not trying to sit here and tell you, hey, Muniz is going to look great in the striking. But yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think he's going to go out there and do something stupid that will get him knocked out very early in this fight. Could happen because of how good of a striker Uriah Hall is. You can just tell that the more cage time Muniz gets, the more comfortable he feels on his feet. And that's a big key, because if he's not shooting in from as far away, it's going to make the success rate of his takedowns much higher. So I do like Muniz, but this is a very important fight in his career.
Strickland Pereira up at the top, near the top of the card, but up at the top, you have Israel Adesanya taking on Jared Cannonier, a fresh challenger. Can't wait for it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, originally set to be Jim Miller against Bobby Green. Green is out, and Donald Cerrone was booked every other weekend to take on Joe Lauzon, but those fights fell out. So up at 170 pounds, yes, 170 pounds, Cowboy Cerrone is going to be taking on A-10 Jim Miller, who's looking to push his win streak to three. And if you look at these guys in the overall pantheon of UFC lore, they each rank very highly in all-time categories. So for Jim Miller, he will extend and make it 40 fights in the UFC. Like, how wild is that? He debuted in 2008, years and years and years ago. But the craziest part about it is nobody's going to be able to stake a claim until this Saturday, because they're both tied for number one overall in most wins in the UFC, tied with Andrei Arlovsky at 24. How crazy is that, Matt?
It's absolutely insane to me, and especially, okay, without looking at your notes, Craig, because I'm assuming it's in there, do you know where these guys originally fought their first fight?
Not WEC.
It used to be a mecca of fights, but it isn't anymore.
They IFL? Fought,
no, Atlantic City for the UFC. Oh, yeah. Atlantic City was where it was at for boxing, and even MMA for
Trump
a short period
Mahal.
Of time. It was a big deal. The Vegas of the East Coast to many people. And it is wild that you don't really hear about Atlantic City anymore being one of those fight destinations or a big fight town. But again, for the longest time, it was sort of seen as that, which is wild to me that we've gone so far away from it. But Donald Cowboy Cerrone and Jim Miller have been in the UFC since Atlantic City was a big deal. So that's really my best way of aging this fight.
But when I do look at this one, because a big talking point has to be that this one's at welterweight. For Cerrone, he's realized intense success at 170. His fight against Joe Lauzon was to be at 155. They both weighed in, and then after the fact, Lauzon's knee locked up. He got it fixed up, so you'll love to see that. But for Cerrone, well, he had a beard, and he shaved it. And then at 155, he looked ghastly on the
Didn't
scale,
look good, did he?
Which isn't, you know, uncommon for Donald Cerrone at 155. And don't get it twisted, Cerrone's had success at 155, and his most recent run of success was at 155. Like, look at that fight against Alexander Hernandez. We had bad blood, and Cerrone was on the winning end of that one. Fights Mike Perry at 170, looked amazing in that one. But I do look at it for Jim Miller.
He was a 2007 US KBA welterweight champ. But since that time in 2007, he had one fight at a catchweight of 162.6 pounds against Thiago Alves. Because Alves couldn't make weight at 155.
He could barely make weight at 170 and then decided to move down to lightweight.
And Jim Miller beat him. Now, that was a unanimous decision win at UFC 205. And then after that, the only fight Jim Miller's had outside of 155 was at 160, a catchweight against Roosevelt Roberts, where Roosevelt went for a big action, fumbled, and then, like, fumbling the ball, Jim Miller was able to pick it up. So for Broncos, let's ride. Jim Miller's on this win streak. And again, the weirdest part for me when I look through Jim Miller's run from 2019 to now, he's 5-3. The losses are to good fighters. The wins are over. Jason Gonzalez is one of the wins. If I ask any MMA fan, hey, you remember Jason Gonzalez in the UFC? They're not going to know who he is. Do you know who Eric Gonzalez is? No, you don't. But Jim Miller was able to cold cock him and knock him out. The most impressive win from 2019 to now, it's not Clay Guida. That was a knock him out, drag him out one round. It was his last fight against Nicholas Motti. He was fighting a guy who could not pick up Jim Miller. Miller was piecing apart the inside leg. And then when it came to it, Miller was really mixing in his boxing combinations while landing to the body to the point where Motti couldn't figure him out. And Iron Motti making his UFC debut, primarily known as a striker, and Jim Miller knocked him out. That was so impressive to me for Miller as an underdog to be almost 39 years old. I can't get over that win that Jim Miller had his last time out.
I fucking love this fight, Craig. I'm not going to lie. Because for Cowboys,
I went deep.
And, like, this is such a fun fight. And I know we were both really big on this when Cowboy was fighting Joe Lozon. Just, hey, at 170, if they did this matchup, I think Cowboy would probably win that. They're very close to each other,
yeah.
Sort of in the whole grand scheme of their careers, really. Like, I don't think Lozon or Cowboy are going to be looking to have a lot more fights after their original matchup. But we're both really worried about how is Cowboy going to look at 155. Because he had trouble cutting into that weight class 6, 7 years ago before he made his initial move up to 170, and normally weight doesn't get easier to cut as you get older. And that's the thing about Cowboy. He did have to cut the weight the last time out against Joe Lozon, okay?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. Remember when Tony Ferguson cut down to 155 and then did the exact same thing 2 weeks later and got his brain beat in by Justin Gaethje? I'm just saying, I don't love it when a guy cuts weight when they don't have to. And for Cowboy, it's not like he knew he didn't have to. Like, he was expecting to have a fight later on that day. But I don't love the fact that it is quite the extreme weight cut for him. And now he's going to have to put his body through it again. And again, I don't think Cowboy cuts a lot to get to 170. I even remember when he was fighting a lot more regularly at 170. He would talk about, hey, I only walk around at like 176, 174, so this weight cut isn't a big deal for me. I basically walk into a sauna, 10 minutes I walk out and I've lost the weight already. But still, if you've already compromised your body to a certain degree, do we know that you've already been able to recover 100% from that? And now that you're fighting a guy who, oddly enough, does have heavy hands, I didn't think I'd be calling Jim Miller at 38 years old at welterweight a heavy-handed fighter, but Miller is one of these guys, so if you make a mistake, you can capitalize on it and it'll be the last mistake you make in the fight. But he has also been a fighter who, as of late, will sit down a lot more on his punches and really make you pay for his overhands and his hooks. And if Cowboy shows up to this fight like he showed up to the Alex Morono one, like, that was by far the worst version of Cowboy we've ever seen.
That's it. You've seen the worst version of Cowboy's last time out. Standing TKO loss where he was, like, lost in that one. And Morono's a good striker. He's a Taekwondo black belt. He's got a black belt in Jiu-Jitsu. But for Cerrone, it was a big step down from the guys he's been fighting. For Miller, he got wobbled a hard right hand from Nicholas Motti in the first round of that fight, and then he just kind of, like, stumbles back in and rolls with it and then gets right back into the fight. And I look at the finishing sequence in that one. It was leg kick going body head and right hook into the ground and pound where he's able to finish Motti. So it was wild stuff for Miller. So you have, like, A-10 at his peak in his last fight against Donald Cerrone at his worst in that fight against Alex Morono. And the last time you saw Cowboy in a ring, in a cage, was a year and a month ago. The last time you saw Jim Miller was just about 4 months ago. So I do look at this one. You look at the odds. Miller opened to minus 155, minus 220 right now. For Donald Cerrone, open to plus 135, plus 176, Matt. We'll have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Miller.
Oh, yeah, over.
And it's 81% Miller, 481 total votes, 81% Miller, 19% Cerrone. The biggest key that I have to this one is I expect them to both strike, even though both guys are very, very strong grapplers. Jim Miller, the last time we saw him try and really get into an extended grappling sequence, the Joe Selecki fight, bigger guy, had success. Cerrone's been grappling with top guys at Syndicate, at the BMF Ranch. We saw him. Who'd he take on? Didn't he take on Craig Jones at a grappling tournament here in the last 6 months or so?
He's like, been doing a lot more no-gi stuff.
He's been doing no-gi stuff, so you like to see that one. But this is the biggest key to me in this fight, and I could be completely wrong in this one, but Jim Miller coming into this one, a southpaw. The body kicks open against an orthodox Donald Cerrone who struggled against body kicks. So it opens that up, opens the lead leg. But power for power, that makes this fun. And at 170, that could be a key for Cerrone to capitalize on.
I like Jim Miller on the feet, but I'm not really convinced of his kicks. And this is why. Cowboy can defend body kicks pretty well. He is good at getting his knee up to help kind of make that whole post to defend kicks. The problem is, how long is he going to be able to keep any kind of sustainable defense? Because for Jim Miller, I've seen him get hurt and recover from those big shots. It happens almost in every Jim Miller fight. Like, win, lose, or draw, he gets hit clean, gets wobbled, and then normally gets way meaner, gets way more aggressive, and we'll see what happens after that. When's the last time we saw Cowboy get hit by a big shot that didn't immediately lead to a finishing sequence? Been years.
Like that Tony Ferguson fight, like I know he blew his nose and whatever, but you have to get to the point where you blow your nose for it then to blow up.
Like Tony landed a right hand jab, ducked out of a shot, and then hit him with a spinning elbow. Like Cowboy at this stage of his career is a very upright boxer who will throw kicks. I should liken him a lot more to a Muay Thai artist because he does throw a lot more kicks. But other than the Anthony Pettis fight where he hit him with a head kick in the third round of that fight, he hasn't really been doing a lot of massive damaging shots as of late. So I don't think Cowboy's all of a sudden going to become the fighter that he used to be. And a chin and durability is one of the few areas of MMA that you can never get back once it's gone. Roy Jones Jr. is one of my favorite fighters regardless of sports ever. But in 2003, he lost 5% of his athleticism. And when you're as good as he is and as fast as he is, you can get away with a lot of mistakes. And when you make all those mistakes and then lose your athleticism, it's going to get you caught that much earlier. I think with Cowboy, he was able to be unorthodox because he was so fast, he was so powerful. But at this stage of his career, he doesn't really have that level of explosiveness. So I worry about him a lot in this fight against Jim Miller. I favor him slightly, or I like him a little bit more in this fight just because it's at 170. But I still think Miller's going to be able to get the win.
Look at Cerrone with that tie stance to have that lead leg up and be able to block some of those kicks from Miller, because Miller really does depend on the leg kicks to set up his shots. More looping shots out of Miller, straight shots out of Cerrone. He could have a lot of success there, Matt. But for me, it's Miller time. It's highlight time. Jim Miller to win the rematch between these two guys. Both of us going with the man out of, they bill him at a Sparta, New Jersey. It is Jim Miller to get the win. I love this fight. Let us know down below in the comment section whether you have A10, whether it's Cowboy. We have some big-time fights left on this card. Some big ones at 185, including the main event between Israel Adesanya and Jared Cannonier. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, in the future, Gary, looking to be the second big-time champ in the UFC behind his idol, Conor McGregor. He's taking on gifted Gabe Green. And in terms of excitement level for fights coming up this weekend, I love this fight. Because if you watch Gabe Green's last fight, he got fucking floored by the biggest right hand you're ever going to see in your whole life. Stop whatever you're doing. If you're on a plane listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wait till you safely land. Turn airplane mode off. Go on Fight Pass and watch Gabe Green, because he drops his hand and Lioness lands the big, like, windmill overhand right. Flush on Green. Green face plants in. Then Lioness gets, he gets into an opportune position. He's in side control. Green recovers himself, gets back up. As that fight goes on, Lioness slows down. Green starts to take over. And if you've ever watched a Gabe Green fight, there's a few things that you need to know. Well, but even before his fight against Johan Lioness, he had corrective eye surgery to get rid of the fact that he had no depth perception and couldn't catch a ball. Well, all of a sudden, now he can see. Well, now he's a world beater. And oh, by the way, in training last year, he had a fight that was booked. It fell out because he got hit to the heart and nearly had a heart attack. He was in hospital for a few days. He had to recover for a few months. So Gabe Green went through some crazy stuff before his fight against Johan Lioness. And Lioness was billed as this South Shore badass out of Montreal. He was this wicked striker that could knock out a horse. Yep. Gabe Green proved that he's an iron horse. He's got just an iron heart as well and an iron will. So wow. For Gabe Green, change it to Iron as your nickname. For Ian Gary, get rid of the future. The
Gabe Green, thick skin and an elastic heart.
Ian Gary's... Shia LaBeouf was in that music video. Ian Gary, though, for the future, I don't like the nickname, but I love it because for Gary, about this time last year, he won the Cage Warriors welterweight title. He beat a lightweight in poor Mr. Jack Grant, but he did it so decisively and looked amazing there. Before that, the win over Jack Grant, win over Rostam Akman, the hair sweater guy, a win over Lawrence Tracy by TKO. getting it done, making moves, starting grooves before they knew we were gone, ends up in the UFC. When you look at it for Jack Grant, some of the promo material, it's the fact that he had over 300 boxing matches, started at the age of 10. By the age of 18, he was a black belt in judo because Conor McGregor was a champ, so he had to kind of make those moves. But when you do look at it, Ian Garry's one of those guys that subscribes to the diet of TB12 and the McGregor fast system. Just, Ian Garry, don't talk about it, be about it. Here's the thing that I cannot...
He's about it.
He is, but here's the thing. If you're this good in all of your press conferences and stuff, if you're as funny as you like to tell us, don't just rehash old lives that other people have used. That's the one thing that bothers me, because Ian Garry has everything. He's a good-looking guy. He has a fun fighting style.
Swinging a big hammer.
He has a very fun personality. He's someone who likes to be on camera. But you only talk about how, oh, I'm like Chael Sonnen and Conor McGregor. I can talk as well as anybody. But I couldn't tell you a single line Ian Garry has ever said in a press conference. And I could do a ton of them with Conor and Chael Sonnen. It's been a while since I've been a UFC fan to that point where I was like watching the press conferences trying to remember the lines. But still, like Ian Garry, we hear about all this great stuff. But up until this point, it's been a lot of promise. And the results have still been good, don't get me wrong. He's an undefeated former champion who's only 24 years old. It's just... We talk about Ian Garry like he's already this champ in the future, but we have yet to really see him put in the work to get to that point. And I do liken it a little bit to Devin Haney fighting George Kambosos Jr. not that long ago. Devin Haney was very hyped up going into that fight. He flew down to another man's home country and fought him in front of 60,000 people. But Haney up until that point, and I think what you said about him winning the Cage Warriors title against a smaller guy is great. Don't worry, pat on the back for that. Because Devin Haney fought guys who were smaller than him moving up to his weight class. He was fighting guys who were past their prime, and he was kind of taking some damage in those fights. He was winning, but there was always an oh, by the way. And I gotta be honest, I liken Ian Garry a little bit to a guy like Devin Haney, where if everything goes right and he is able to check all the boxes on his potential, then yes, I really do think Ian Garry, if he can combine his wrestling with how pure his striking looks, yes, he could be a top 15 guy in the future. It's just, I hate it when we talk about these guys doing the things they have yet to do. Gabe Green's a really difficult fight for anybody in the UFC. He has good takedowns. He has a good chin. He has absurd power if he's able to land on you himself. This is my whole point with Jack Della Maddalena when he fought Ramzan Ameev. It was, hey, you have a hyped up prospect against a very boring fighter, for being honest, but a good one at that, who can make anybody look bad on any given day. What did Jack Della Maddalena go and do? He turned his organ smashed potatoes, hit him with a bunch of body shots, didn't take a single punch, and now we understand why he's so hyped up as a prospect. Ian Garry needs a performance like that, almost like a flawless performance, for the more broad-based fans to really get on board with him, because I feel like he does have a very big following in Europe, and he's starting to get a following in the UFC, but he gets cracked a lot early in a lot of his shots. He does tend to fight at his opponent's strengths sometimes, and I do worry about that when he's fighting upper echelon guys in the UFC.
That's a weird thing. For Ian Garry, the fight against Jordan Williams, he knocked out Gregory Rodriguez. Yeah. That's real, but in that fight, he almost knocked out Ian Garry. And then Ian Garry rallied back and knocked him out, and he gets a bonus out of it, and it was entertaining, and you get to go on the mic and have some fun. His last fight was against Darian Weeks, and I like Darian Weeks. Comes out of a smaller gym. He's got wrestling in his back pocket. He can crack. He has good boxing, like good solid fundamentals as Darian Weeks. I know Ian Garry won that fight 30-27s, 29-28 on one judge's scorecard. Darian Weeks pushed the action, wrestled him up against the cage, had him behind the black line for a lot of that fight. Like, I know Garry won it, and Gary's volume was good, but Darian Weeks brought the fight to him. And I look at this fight, and I kind of draw some parallels. Like, you look at the odds for Garry when he fought Jordan Williams, minus 425 favorite. Darian Weeks, minus 400. When he's taking on Gabe Green, minus 160. So if you really like Ian Garry, there's a lot of value right there in taking on Gabe Green. And listen, going gets tough. You fight better fighters. Gabe Green, unranked fighter. Maybe you've never heard of him. That's fair. He took his fight on short notice to get into the UFC, replacing Kevin Holland fighting Dana Rodriguez. And just like that, like Darian Weeks losing to Ian Garry, Gabe Green brought the fight to Dana Rodriguez, lost the fight, 30-27s abound. I watched that fight and went, fuck me, Gabe Green looks pretty fucking good. Like, I want to see this guy fight again. So Gabe Green goes out there, and what does he do? He fights Phil Rowe. Knocks him down twice. Round two, round three. Wins that fight. Wow, okay, Gabe Green. Like, this is pretty good. Phil Rowe's looked good since then. His last time out against Linus, gets dropped by that overhand right, solidly onto the mat, and then rallies after that round two and looks amazing. Now, of course, Linus tired, but you're going to tire when you go for a finish like that. So, again, I do look at this fight. I absolutely love it. Gary the favorite, minus 160. The comeback on Gabe Green is around a plus 130. We have a look at the topology votes. Surprise us there to you. I'll say over under 75% Gary.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? Slightly over, 732 total votes, 78% Gary, 58% by decision, 34% by knockout for the 22% that have Green, 54% by decision, 36% by knockout. But Matt, again, when Gary was on the come up, big knockouts, the great judo, great control, beating guys in every aspect of the fight. We've seen him kind of concede a little bit of distance in his fight against Darian Weeks, but he won it by decision. We saw his chin check, but he came through on the other side against Jordan Williams. What do you figure out of this one? Because I still think Ian Gary is that prospect that we thought of him as.
It depends on what prospect you ever thought of him as. Because here's the thing. Welterweight's kind of on the come up right now. There's a crop of new contenders at 170 who's offering just a lot of the old heads, if you will, some very interesting challenges. You have Khamzat Chimaev as sort of the face of this new wave. You have guys like Shavkat Rakhmonov, Jack Della Maddalena, who I just brought up. Ian Gary, another one of these hot prospects. I look at him as a clear number four out of those top four, though, if I'm being honest. And I think this fight against Gabe Green's an interesting one because Green's someone who does have holes in his game. You can hit him clean early on because he is a little wild. So I think Ian Gary could win by first round knockout. We all think, wow, he is that prospect. But there's also another world where he hurts Green, similar to Green's last fight against Lioness. And then Green gets up and makes the fight really ugly. And I just don't know what Ian Gary's answer is going to be in an ugly fight after that first round because he can wrestle, he can box, he's a very well-rounded mixed martial artist. I just don't know what his natural tendency is going to go to against a guy like Gabe Green. So I think this is going to be an ugly fight for both guys. I think it's going to be very difficult for either guy to look very good in this matchup. But I do think Gary, ever so slightly, is the more technical guy. And I think that's why he's going to be able to win.
Gabe Green has better footwork in this matchup. He has better core movement. He has more head movement. See what I did there? It's not better, though. He moves his head a lot. He still gets hit a lot. Like, he doesn't
move it into punches.
Gabe Green, yeah, Gabe Green does not hold his hands up all the time. He holds them low, and then he moves his head, and he moves into punches. Like, I've seen that time and again. I saw it in his last fight against Lioness. For a guy that winds up on his power, all of his shots in Lioness, Gabe Green got hit clean, not just by that overhand right that dropped him, but by even just pawing jabs, he was hit. Ian Gary is a very technical and a guy that has a lot of accuracy behind his shots. Now, the thing that I worry about is Gabe Green has good footwork and he can cut the cage. Ian Gary's a guy that can get backed up. And listen, I take these things with a grain of salt when the commentary talks about it during a fight because they have a narrative. Sometimes we can fall into that trap, I'll be honest. But John Anik talked about it. He said, in talking with Ian Gary, getting ready for Darian Weeks, he said, Ian's used to training with shorter guys. Gabe Green's a shorter guy, so he's used to being able to lean back.
Guys, I've been saying this for a while.
And the point of it is, he says, well, Gary realized it, so in this training camp, he's been working to minimize it. But even in the fight, his last time out against Darian Weeks, he still backs up with his head back.
Daniel Cormier famously said in a press conference before he fought Jon Jones, hey, I know you're going for the left high kick because I've leaned that way, but it's not going to work because I fixed that. What happened when they fought the next time? And I hate Jon Jones and love Daniel Cormier, but facts are facts. He head kicked him with that thing. I know Gary might be working. Gary might be working to get rid of that wrinkle from his game, but I think it takes more than one training camp. We see this all the time. People switch training camps and still fight like the exact same fighter they were. It normally takes one, two, three training camps for you to finally get rid of that wrinkle in your game. So for Gary, I do appreciate that he has the self-awareness to realize that, hey, this has been a problem for me. It's a problem in my training. If I fix it in my training, it should help me in the gym. So I do really appreciate that. But I still think that's going to be a hole that's going to show in this fight. And against a guy like Gabe Green, who can string together combinations and land big shots, it's a dangerous fight. But I still like Ian Gary. And I brought up the name Jack Della Maddalena several times because that's the fight we need to see at this weight class. Both guys want to be that prospect to get into the top 15 next. I think that'd be perfect matchmaking if Ian Gary is able to beat Gabe Green.
I love Gabe Green for what he's worth, and I'm sure I'm going to pick him in a lot of these fights. I might surprise people here, but I do like Ian Gary. The thing that I like about Green is he's well-rounded. His physique is off the charts. In his last fight, he looked bigger. Movement, volume, power. He has everything. Ian Gary is so well-versed in judo. I don't know why we didn't see it against Darian Weeks, because Weeks is a good wrestler in his own right, but I think Ian Gary has that edge over a lot of guys. I think he has it in this fight. Green excels in a lot of positions up against the cage, so maybe Gary loses minutes there. All in all, I think this is a really close fight. You can't go wrong either way. Tough I just fight. Look at a guy in Gary that goes from a minus 425 to minus 400 to minus 160. I gotta go with Ian Garry in that circumstance. So I think it's a really close fight. Both of us going with Ireland's the future, Ian Garry. Again, let us know in the comments section below, because I'm on the fence about this one. I'm honest with you folks. If you make a great argument against Gabe Green, I'll give you your flowers over there in the comments section. Great title fights up at the top of this card. Should be an amazing one. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Fight Night Picks, if you know anything about us, you know that if we were able to have any matchmaking abilities, we would have put together fights like Mateusz Gamrot and Armin Zarukian, like you had in last week's main event. But if you let Joe Rogan make fights, he'd probably go with Donald Cerrone and Jim Miller too, or Robbie Lawler and Brian Barberena. And that's exactly what we have this weekend. So I hope that Anik and whoever else is in the booth just gives Joe the mic and he gets to commentate for this one. Because if you look at it, for Robbie Lawler, 14-9 just in the UFC, former champion, he wins the belt against Johnny Hendricks, UFC 181, best poster ever, and that was a great fight. And then he goes out there, he beats Rory McDonald, hangs on to the belt, beats Carlos Condit in a fight of the night, holds on to the belt.
Fight of the year.
Then he gets knocked out in the first round against Tyron Woodley, and he hasn't looked the same since. Now, has he won fights since? Yes, he has. And I mean, his last fight against Nick Diaz was a really good win. And if you're like me, and you think about that fight in your mind's eye, you go, well, Nick Diaz looked bad. And I've got something to tell you. I went back and rewatched that twice today. Nick Diaz looked bad in the first 30 seconds. He looked bad in the last 30 seconds where he drops down to a knee, then to his butt, then he grabs his knee, and then Jason Herzog goes, can you continue? And he goes, nope.
Well, he broke his nose and quit.
Yeah, I looked at that one and I thought, okay, end of it's bad, start of it's bad, but the rest of it's pretty damn good. Nick Diaz put together great boxing combinations. He was ripping to the body. He was throwing his lead left as a jab, but he was also throwing it as a hook, and he had a lot of accuracy on it. He also threw a lot of volume, but in that fight, it was a lot of fun while it lasted between those two guys. But for Robbie Lawler, there's a lot of crazy things I can talk about. I could say, hey, he's got a tramp stamp that looks like in a foreign language that somebody wrote, I make questionable decisions. But other than that, Matt, Robbie Lawler, when he's not fighting like a really good wrestler, a guy that's knocking him out, he has some pretty good success, right?
We ask ourselves this a lot on this channel. Like, what are these fighters willing to go through to win? I don't have to ask that when Robbie Lawler's fighting.
Or Brian Barberena.
No. Like, Robbie Lawler, I have seen win fights off, like, he's on death's doorstep. He's taken so much damage. Like, yeah, Brian Barberena's gut hurt and come back and look good. Robbie Lawler split his lip from his lip to his nose and still knocked a guy out. Like, there's no quit in Robbie Lawler at all. I don't care what happens in an MMA fight. If the first two rounds he gets 10-8 in, he's still going to try with everything he has in the third, fourth, and fifth. I have to go back to the Colby Covington fight, which stylistically was terrible for him. But what was his best round in that fight? Fifth round, he was pushing Covington back. He had defended a few takedowns. He still lost that fight in a very one-sided fight. But still, Lawler, he behaved in the way that you want a champion to behave in. He got better as the fight went on. I think that's a really important thing. Even against Nick Diaz, and you're right, Diaz looked okay on some of the in-betweens, but the problem was he didn't put anything behind any of his shots. You can throw your arms out like this all day long. If you're not putting any power behind your shots, your arms aren't going to get as tired as a result, and it's going to make your volume even easier to throw. Lawler, once he was able to realize, okay, there's no real repercussion for standing in the pocket. Like, I can land my own power shots too. You could see the confidence in Robbie Lawler start to build as that fight continued. Now, the difference is, the second he hit Nick Diaz with one really clean shot, Nick Diaz was looking for a way out. He was like, damn, it's been years since I've done this and I've made a lot of money in my life. Brian Barberena is a little bit different, though, and he's at a very different stage of his career, and that's why I think this fight's going to be so fun, because I think Lawler's still going to fight in that very same manner, but I think Barberena is willing to take a lot more punishment and try to dish his own out. And the interesting thing about this fight is that we've seen multiple versions of both guys. The difference is, with Lawler, it's kind of the trajectory you see out of a lot of athletes. They get better, they reach the pinnacle, and then they start to get worse as they get older, and they start their decline. Lawler, yes, he was able to kind of halt that with his last performance, but still, the last four top tier fighters he's fought, he has been on the losing side of those fights. But with Barberena, post stomach surgery and post some of his own injuries, he hasn't necessarily been the same guy that he was all the way back when he fought Vicente Luque and even Randy Brown. He does seem to be slightly more hesitant on the outside. He even uses his own offensive wrestling a little bit more in his fights. So I'll be curious to see what version of Barberena we get, because you know he's probably thinking, okay, I'm fighting an older guy who's 40. If Barberena comes into this fight looking to throw bombs in the feet with Robbie Lawler, we're in for an absolute treat.
Wait,
of a fight.
Yeah, he just did that in March against Matt Brown, had a fight of the night against the hometown guy, because that was an Ohio fight night. And Matt Brown was a big time, you know, fan favorite. And obviously, you know, you could argue either way about the decision, but the biggest part about it was Barbarina was cracking on the feet like it was 2016, and his takedown defense was like it was in 2022. Because that's the thing, like, I go through Brian Barbarina's fights, and I'm excited about this one. 14-9 in just the UFC. That's not Elite XC, that's not Strike Force for Robbie Lawler, Zuffa Banner. 14-9. Brian Barbarina, 8-6. And I look at the losses. An early Chad Laprise loss. All right, it is what it is. You lose to Colby Covington, Leon Edwards, Vicente Luque, Randy Brown. All right, top 15 or periphery of the top 15. Brian Barbarina's loss to Jason Witt. Jason Witt gets knocked out on the feet, but if he doesn't get knocked out on the feet, he's taking you down and he's going to deep waters. And for Mr. Barbarina, if you look at his last four fights, he's 3-1. That's very good. Anthony Ivey, 5 of 24 on takedown attempts, but the takedowns were a big story for Ivey when it was on the feet, Barbarina. Jason Witt went 8 of 18. Then you have Darian Weeks, 4 of 8 in a fight that was close. And then the last time out, if you look at it against Matt Brown, Matt Brown went 5 of 7 on his takedown attempts. So again, 5, 8, 4, and 5. Those aren't good totals to be taken down. And Barbarina, once he gets the mat, he works his damnedest to get back up, but he gets taken down to the mat a fair bit in his fights. Now, again, beats Ivy by decision. Good fight against Darian Weeks. Split decision fight of the night against Matt Brown. If you look at it career-wise, 4 fight of the nights for Brian Barbarina, and he's had 2 since that kind of career possibly ending
Robbie
injury.
Robbie Lawler's like fight of the night. Fight of years over here.
Robbie Lawler is a fight of the year type of guy. But again, only 55% takedown defense for Brian Barbarina career, so it's not that great. But you look at this fight, I mean, Matt, stylistically, skill for skill, when they strike, this should be a fun one. And oh, by the way, Robbie Lawler, like Mike Gundy, I'm a man, I'm 40.
And that's the big story of this fight. Lawler isn't the guy he used to be. Like, if this is 2015 Robbie Lawler, the fight's over in 45 seconds. Like, I'm not even joking how fast this
He's
fight
He's going
would
to
be.
The moon.
Yeah, like, Robbie Lawler is one of the all-time great welterweights. He really is. And he was an interesting champion, too, because he was such a fun fighter to watch while he held the belt. Normally, you get the belt and you think, okay, how do I hold on to this? I make a lot more money outside the UFC. I want to maintain my championship for as long as possible. Robbie Lawler turned his aggression up to 11, and shit got wild, and that's why I appreciate it. I think he's going to fight in the same manner that he always has. I don't expect him to go for takedowns, even though Lawler used to wrestle a lot more early on in his career than he does now. Ever since his second run in the UFC.
Because he was still living and training in Iowa with Pat Miletich.
And ever since his second run in the UFC, the Koscheck win, there's a lot of wins his second time over, he hasn't been as much of a wrestler. He's a decent defensive wrestler against people who don't specialize in it, like the Covingtons or even the Usmans of the world would. But I guess a regular wrestler, he can defend a lot of those attempts. I expect this fight to primarily be contested on the feet, but I do think Barbarina is starting to look like the fighter he used to be a little bit more. And even the Matt Brown fight, I know it was a split decision. I thought Barbarina was able to win that fight.
Yep.
And I think Barbarina, if he's able to use some of the same techniques that he employed in that Matt Brown fight, use some kicks, keep this fight at a longer range, I think he'd have a lot of success against Robbie Lawler. But even at 40 years of age, I think Lawler's going to make this a very fun fight and one that you're not going to want to miss.
This should be a fun one. You look at the odds for this fight, and Lawler open a plus 130. He's now minus 125 underdog for Barbarina. Open the favorite minus 130. Plus 105, 103, somewhere around there. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise that's there to you. I would think former champ gets the respect with the fans. I'm going to say over-under 70% Lawler.
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. It is under, and they're actually really close. So 868 total votes, 54% Lawler, 72% by decision, 22% by knockout for the 46% that have Barbarina, 77% by decision, and 16% by knockout. So again, the odds have shifted. You do now have Robbie Lawler as the favorite. The fans also have Lawler. Do you have Lawler?
I don't. And this is why. I remember an interview that he did after the Nick Diaz fight. And it was very telling to me. He said, hey, the reason I looked good in that Diaz fight was that's a fight I could get up for. Like, you signed the contract to fight Nick Diaz. You're excited for that. That's
and
a legacy
185
fight.
Too on short notice.
But no, they thought, no, it wasn't. That fight was signed for 170 and switched to 185 the week of the fight because Nick Diaz didn't want to cut the weight. But no, Robbie Lawler showed up thinking he was going to fight at 170.
So they ended up at 185 on short notice. Here nor there, but I understand what you mean as well.
My whole thing for Robbie Lawler was that he was fighting an opponent that he could get excited for because both guys are kind of the future Hall of Famer talk. You know what I mean? Like, Nick Diaz, one of the most famous fighters of all time. Same thing with Robbie Lawler. Those are fights that when you're 40 years old, they'll make you train like you did when you were 32 years old. I don't think Robbie Lawler signed the contract against Brian Barbarina and probably felt that same enthusiasm to go back into a training camp. At 40 years of age, again, I think Lawler is that champion. Like, This is going to sound so cheesy, but I'm going to say it anyways. Like, when you're a champion, you, like, if I saw Robbie Lawler and we became friends, I would call him champ. No matter what. Like
Shannon Briggs.
But when you are a champion, you are a champion no matter what. Because it's so hard to get to that point to begin with. For Robbie Lawler, he went through hell to become a UFC fighter. And even his second run after he lost the belt has been very difficult. But he's never taken an easy fight even during this stretch. He fought Neil Magny, who was really good at the time. Colby Covington, RDA in a main event. Like, he's never taken an easy fight. Until now, which is wild to say that, like, when you're as good as Robbie Lawler, Brian Barberena is an easy fight. I think this is going to be one of those fight of the night contenders, but I do favor Barberena.
Barberena cracks. He's got great long-range weapons, understands distance, also takes a lot of damage. But when I do look at this, you look at that Lawler fight rematch against Diaz. The first time they fought was UFC 47. When they still named them the name of it, Big John would get behind it. It's on. And he got flatlined by a hook and knocked out. And Nick Diaz won that one. He looked great in his last fight. But again, for Lawler's last time out, he had volume. He had a good right hand. He could mix it up and throw uppercuts from both sides. But the craziest part for Lawler is when he goes to throw his power shots, and even when he's thinking about striking and closing the distance, because he was closing the distance against Nick Diaz. He pressed the pace the whole fight. Low left hand got hit a lot on that side. So can Barberena figure that out, land his own shots? Robbie Lawler will kick. He had a great body kick against Nick Diaz.
One of the all-time great head kick knockouts in this division.
But again, that body kick against Diaz was a big one. And I love the kicks out of Lawler. For that reason, I like him against Barberena. I like the volume. I like the power. I like the fact that, listen, these wrestlers have been able to figure him out. Magny was able to stall him out. Covington was as well. Again, so was RDA in the coldest main event you could have in Winnipeg, Canada. But for me, I do like the former champ in Robbie Lawler. We're split on the pick. This is an amazing fight. Joe Rogan's going to be so excited about it, and you should be too. Can't wait for it, and some big fights to come. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming off his first loss since 2016, Brad Riddell is going to be looking to solve the riddle that is the eight-legged wonder, the tarantula Jalen Turner. Matt, is that the best opening line I've ever come up with?
I don't think so.
Oh, shade. But Matt, for Brad Riddell, he had lost on the regional scene down in the Anzac region. He got submitted, went on a wicked, wicked run streak, took on the former Tiger Muay Thai striking coach, him being a former Tiger Muay Thai striking coach as well. It was a battle of the strikers. It was the Spider-Man meme. And for Brad Riddell, it was kind of competitive. I mean, he did have Fazeev bloodied up. And then Fazeev went, well, that's cute. Spinning wheel kick and knocked him out. And again, some people at the time said it was an early stoppage. It is what it is. Riddell kind of like was out of it. So I didn't think it was that bad of a stoppage. But when it does come to this fight, I mean, for Riddell, the fight against Fazeev was back in December. So it has been some time. For Jalen Turner, this guy's had a wild ride in the UFC. Whether it's a fight with Vicente Luque at 170 pounds, whether you look at another one of his losses against Matt Frivola where he gets totally out-wrestled, he's really come back from those stronger. He's on a 4-fight win streak, finished Joshua Kalibau. That win age as well, even though Kalibau jumped up to take it. Beat Brock Weaver badly. Beat Uros Medic badly. Beat Jamie Mullerkey really badly. And now for Turner, he gets to take on his first ranked lightweight in this division. And when you look at it for Turner, he gets hit a little bit on the feet. He hits guys a lot of bit and has a lot of really good power. And when the fight goes down to the mat, he's got some decent wrestling, but some very, very slick grappling as well. Sometimes he can get held down and his big frame is a disadvantage. And sometimes then it's an advantage. So I can talk out of both sides of my mouth for the advantages and disadvantages for the tarantula. But this matchup here stylistically is a very fun one, and I'm really eager to see this fight.
Up until the last line, you were selling me like the luxury package of Jalen Turner. I agree with a lot of what you said, but that Matt Frivola loss is a tough one. Let's just all call it what it is. He has looked good since that fight, but that's a very bad loss for a guy as talented as Jalen Turner to take in his career, because I thought he was going to blow the doors off Frivola. I really did. Turner's the much bigger striker. Like you said, he's a well-rounded guy with his game, but Turner's one of these interesting fighters, so I almost liken it to when Juliana Pena had beat Amanda Nunes. Nunes, better in a lot of sort of the more obvious aspects of MMA, but Pena found that one thing she could take advantage of, and it was cardio. It was the relentlessness of her game that she was able to just sort of kind of make Amanda wilt under her pressure. With Jalen Turner, he's an interesting fighter because at very long range, when guys want to stand with him, he lights them up on the feet. With jiu-jitsu, when he's the one who's sort of leading the dance, he can be very effective. But there are some of those in-betweens. Like, if a striker's good on the feet but also good in the clinch, he doesn't necessarily have a lot of tools to deal with a guy like that, or someone who's a very dominant wrestler who can just hold him down, not create a lot of separation, not really make the fight fun, but just use their physicality to hold him down. Those are fighters who can have success with a guy like Jalen Turner, and I think the striking side of that equation is going to make this fight very interesting, because if Turner can use his footwork, which has always kind of been an issue for him, because if he is using his feet very well, if he's getting his back off the cage, inviting a lot of those open cage exchanges, then Jalen Turner is going to be a very hard guy to hit because of how lanky he is, but also a very hard guy to withstand his power too. We see as kind of an unnatural pop at the end of his shots. You don't look at Jalen Turner and think, wow, that guy can go out there and get a lot of knockouts at the UFC level, but he is a very technical striker and a very accurate one too. But against Brad Riddell, I don't think he's going to have the luxury of having sort of the range that he's comfortable with and having a guy just slowly walk into him like some of his last opponents, because that is the thing about Jalen Turner. Other than Jamie Mullarkey, I mean, Brad Riddell would also beat Joshua Caulibau. He would also beat some of those other guys too. So other than Mullarkey, I wasn't completely sold on Turner. But if he looks like the guy who absolutely destroyed Jamie Mullarkey the last time out, this fight against Brad Riddell is fight of the night written all over
it. Mullarkey had a fight of the night against Brad Riddell. It was back and forth. Mullarkey rocked him. He rocked Mullarkey. He took Mullarkey down. That was a big kind of talking point of that fight. For Jalen Turner, it was weird because Mullarkey's one of those guys. He's also very big for the division, but not as tall, not as long. And Turner was able to really kind of work his range, and that's a thing that he really has to figure out. I mean, again, if you look at this fight, Turner has 8 inches of height and 6 inches of reach on Brad Riddell. Brad Riddell's a world-class striker that understands how to get into boxing range or find his own range to beat some of these guys. But on the flip side, Brad Riddell's been hit at long range as well in the UFC and rocked. And when I look at Brad Riddell and his wrestling, it can be a positive to mix things up in some of his fights. But in this one, like, Matt Frivola is a wrestler and a wrestler that's going to hold you down. Brad Riddell's a wrestler that's going to mix it in to work some of his striking. I think if Brad Riddell's going to be taking Jalen Turner down, something went wrong in the striking.
But the flip side is, Matt Frivola's a guy who can't take a shot on the feet at all, and Jalen Turner can hit pretty hard. So, if you think Jalen Turner has good stopping power on the feet, you would think, hey, he'd probably be able to clip Matt Frivola at least one time. So, you can bring up some caveats for both guys in their previous fights. My big point is, what's Jalen Turner going to do to deal with Brad Riddell when he's in the pocket? I don't really know, because Turner's not someone who throws a lot of knees or jumps into them. He's someone who will box and try to circle his back off of the cage. When you're circling your back off of the cage a lot of times, it's going to invite some of the hooks from Brad Riddell, which are by far his best weapon, and that's why I do think styles make fights. You can point to the fact that Turner beat the brakes off Mullarkey, and Mullarkey had a close fight with Riddell. That has nothing to do with this fight. Mullarkey's taken a lot of damage since that first fight with Riddell, and he has not been the same fighter since his first fight with Riddell.
Who did he take damage against?
I mean, Jimmy Mullarkey has like 7 knockout losses on his career.
But the point that I have in this fight is, I like Jalen Turner's knees. We've seen them in the clinch in his fights that he's winning. Those are one of his best attributes.
But against Brock Weaver,
long range weapons, even against Mullarkey, and his body kicks are key. But again, against a guy like Riddell, you throw a body kick and you leave yourself extended and take a long time to recoil. That's when Riddell can push off. He's got those fast twitch muscles. He's able to get the win. So it is a great fight. Jalen Turner, obviously, with the nickname, it goes without saying, he's like the Kijiji of spiders. He buys and sells, and he has a lot of fun with them. The odds in this one, Riddell opened at a plus 150. He's a plus 100, so the line is closing in on par. Turner somehow opened to minus 175, minus 125 right now. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm assuming Brad Riddell is going to be a favorite with the fans. I'm going to say over under 65% Riddell.
I think Turner's going to be the favorite.
Riddell, so 783 total votes, 54% Riddell, 74% by decision for the 46% that have Turner, 19% by decision, 18% by submission, 57% by knockout. Matt, you have Riddell and I have Turner. We pretty much laid it out.
No. That's not it at all. I think Jalen Turner's going to win this fight, but the problem is the fight's going to take place in a range that I think he's going to struggle with against Brad Riddell quite a bit. So it's going to come down to what else can he do in this fight? Because at boxing range, on the feet, in the pocket, Brad Riddell's going to go to the body, going to go to the head, even going to use his own elbows to mix in because that's something he uses very effectively. And I think Turner's going to have a trouble with that. The difference is Turner has other ranges that he can use to still succeed in this fight. He can hit Brad Riddell on the way in and once he's there too. And that's why I ever so slightly do favor Jalen Turner. But I think the fight that this or the range at which this fight is going to take place in will favor Brad Riddell. I just think Turner's going to show us a wrinkle of his game that we haven't seen yet. And that's the big thing about this fight. Both guys are just in the rankings or just outside the rankings. They're kind of battling in that 20 to 15 range. They're going to have to show us something new in their games to really warrant a ranked opponent next. Look at guys like Mateusz Gamrot and Armin Tsarukyan. They have to wait years just for the opportunity to maybe main event. And that was an outlier where the UFC gave us a fun fight that normally they don't give us. So for Turner and Riddell, a very important fight for both their careers. I'm ever so slightly favoring Jalen Turner, but this is a phenomenal fight.
Riddell currently ranked 14th, having just lost to Fazeev. They're making him fight outside of the rankings. Gregor Gillespie's ranked in this one. But he doesn't take very many fights, Gregor Gillespie. Samat, I do like this fight. Both of us going with Jalen Turner to get the win. We get some big-time fights coming up. Some possible fight of the nights. Two title fights. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. For the first time in his young UFC career, 13th ranked Sean O'Malley is going to be taking on a ranked opponent. And you've got it. It's the 35-year-old, nearly 36-year-old, young Punisher, Pedro Munhoz. Now, Matt, I did a deep dive on this one because I looked at it and thought, isn't this strange? Like, wasn't Frank Castle in his mid to late 30s? So if you're Pedro Munhoz and you're the young Punisher, but you're on the level of the real Punisher, when do you drop the young out of it and just become the Punisher?
Shout out to John Bernthal, because that's one of the best shows on Netflix, The Punisher. Highly recommend it if you've never watched it. He's too old to be the young anything. My rule of thumb is, if you're Wonder Boy, if you're the young X, Y, or Z, the second you turn 30, drop it. Even at 29, it's a little weird, but I'll let you get away with it. The second you hit 30, quit calling yourself the young Punisher.
Either way, for Pedro Munhoz, he's on the worst stretch of his UFC career right now. 1-4 in the 5-on-in now. Could he make some arguments in some of these fights?
Have any of them been boring to watch?
No, sure they haven't. I mean, there's some fight of the nights sprinkled in there. He's got 4 fight of the nights in his UFC career. He's got 3 performance bonuses. And if you do look at it, I mean, for Pedro Munhoz, the fight against Dominic Cruz, he hits him with like this short left in tight that Cruz wobbles to the ground, gets right back up. Munhoz kind of like, he's so excited, he falls and then he gets back up, lands a hook, drops Dominic Cruz, and then it's like, is this the Keith Peterson stage of a Dominic Cruz fight? Well, referee goes, no, we're not going to make that mistake again. And then Munhoz, round 2, round 3, doesn't really fall off, but Dominic Cruz gets back into the fight and starts to land wicked volume. It's not like there was a ton of accumulation, but he threw a lot at him, and Munhoz just couldn't really figure it out. And that's a crazy thing. For Munhoz to be this power puncher to some people, for him to land that knockout blow over Cody Garbrandt, and be known as somewhat of a fast starter, back up, because that's not really the case. Munhoz actually does start to land volume as fights go on. I look at his fight against Frankie Edgar. He has a really strong 5th round in that fight. I thought he beat Frankie Edgar. Most people thought he beat Frankie Edgar. 19-4 on MMA Decision thought that he won that one. But regardless, split decision loss in that main event. Lost to Jose Aldo. Very close competitive fight. A loss to Cruz last time out.
The Jose Aldo one, he got pieced up and bad.
But my point out of all of these Pedro Munhoz fights are, you don't want to blink like a Kai Kara France fight, because they are so much fun and they're so action-packed. And the biggest part, the biggest talking point, if you want to go to your friend that's a big Sean O'Malley fan, you want to go and say, wow, I understand this guy's great. He's understanding of distance. He throws great boxing combinations. He rolls with the shots. This is the biggest thing that I have for Pedro Munhoz in his fights. In the Dominic Cruz fight, he landed 19 of 26 leg kicks. Against Aldo, 37 of 42. Against Jimmy Rivera, 40 of 52. These are just examples of his last 3 fights. Pedro Munhoz is a wicked leg kicker. Sean O'Malley obviously has susceptibility to getting leg kicked. Vera was a big example of that because that's his only loss. But in his other fights, that has been a thing because he does tend to stand heavy on his lead leg before he switches stance and moves around. But he doesn't really check leg kicks. Maybe Pedro Munhoz can make that the X factor to then beat Sean O'Malley. But that's a big talking point for Pedro Munhoz's game.
It is a very big component of his game because he does like to set up his bigger power shots with that lower leg kick. And of course, when you do throw big power shots on the feet, it makes your opponent much more stationary if you start to cut down on their legs because they will be much more hittable as a result of it. The only zag I'm going to take here is, the problem with Pedro Munhoz is that, to quote our great grandmother, he is slower than molasses on a cold winter's day. And it is the truth. If you just look at the skill set of Pedro Munhoz, he's a skilled striker. He's extremely skilled at his jiu-jitsu. Go back and watch the majority of his earlier fights. That's how he's able to win. He's that good of a grappler. The problem is, He's so slow, it's not even funny. Like, you have to stand there and almost want to be hit by Pedro Munhoz to be hit by him. And a lot of the fighters that you bring up, especially with the leg kick totals, are there to be hit or have to have the fight in boxing range slash wrestling range to have success. Jimmy Rivera, a good example of that. Frankie Edgar, Dominic Cruz, all three of those fighters fight in almost the exact same manner. They have to be close to you, so there's the threat of the takedown, and none of them really kick. They all have to use their hands to do a lot of their offensive work on the feet. Sean O'Malley's 7 inches taller than Pedro Munhoz and throws kicks, though, and I really do think...
5 inches of height, 7 inches of reach.
My bad. 5 inches taller and has 7 inches of reach on him. I think stylistically, this is a very poor matchup for Pedro Munhoz. And I really do think that this is strategic matchmaking by the UFC's part. Because there's 13 guys in the top 15 of bantamweight who could probably beat Sean O'Malley. That's how competitive the weight class is. That's how good anybody can be on any given day. The problem is, when you look at guys' X factors and how some people can exploit the weaknesses of others, Pedro Munhoz is slow and he's very hittable in a lot of his fights. Sean O'Malley's very fast and very accurate in the majority of his fights. And I'm going to go back to a boxing fight that happened a couple of weeks ago. Joe Smith Jr. versus Artur Beterbiev. It was a fight that a lot of people were excited for. And Artur Beterbiev won by knockout. How he won by knockout was Pedro Munhoz, who fights a lot like Joe Smith Jr. Joe Smith Jr. would lean in and then try to throw his power shots. Beterbiev would take 1.5 steps back so that when your chin is forward while you're throwing your shots, you're basically perfectly in position for me to hit you with mine. Sean O'Malley fights exactly like that. He's in and out of range constantly. He's almost like a cobra. He's either all the way in or all the way out. And that's going to make it very difficult for Munhoz to land those kicks, because if they are in clinching range, well, Munhoz isn't Justin Gaethje, and that's the only guy I've ever seen land consistent calf kicks from a clinch. And I do think that just physically, due to the fact that he is smaller in this matchup, it's going to make this fight very difficult for him on the outer edge of his range, where Chito Vera physically matches up a lot better with Sean O'Malley and has a lot of the same strengths that a guy like Pedro Munhoz does. So I think Munhoz can make this fight very difficult, but the problem is his one glaring weakness is his speed. And if anything is special about Sean O'Malley, if he is an outlier in any one category, he throws punches like Aroldis Chapman used to throw baseballs.
Number one all time, regardless of time, but also division, in strikes landed per minute at 8.37, and the biggest strike differential ever in the UFC at 5.01. Has the level of competition been there? Not really. I mean, Chris Moutinho was there to get hit. He just continued to walk him down and eat shots, and it was a fight of the night somehow. But when you look at it for Sean O'Malley, 2 fight of the nights, 4 performance bonuses, 7-1, including Dana White's contender series. And if you really do focus on it, other than his debut against Tarion Ware, every other fight has been on a pay-per-view card, whether that's prelims or main card. Sean O'Malley obviously draws, but he has that speed factor. And you go back and you look at some of these performances. His last time out was about 6 months ago. He beat Haolian Paiva. Again,
it was barely a fight.
Unranked fighter, but he looked amazing. He lit him on fire. So for Sean O'Malley, he's ranked. Now he's finally taking on a ranked test. And for Pedro Munhoz at 35, drop the young Punisher. But again, those leg kicks could add up in this fight. That could be a huge, huge difference maker. So we look at the odds in this one. Munhoz open a plus 210, still roughly there. If you look at it for O'Malley, open around a minus 250, still roughly there as well. We have a look at the Tapology votes. It's a little bit of a popularity contest sometimes over there. I'm going to say over under 85% O'Malley.
I think they'll be closer to 50, but O'Malley will be the favorite.
904 total votes, 85% O'Malley, 46% by decision, 48% by knockout, 15% that have Pedro Munhoz, 41% by decision, 43% by knockout. Pedro Munhoz has never been finished in the UFC. Maybe this is the time.
I think it is. I really do. Pedro Munhoz is hittable, because this is the wild thing that people like to forget, just because he hasn't been knocked out. Pedro Munhoz is one of the best chins in this division's history. Easily. Like, Munhoz gets hit by shots that would send Cody Garbrandt to another division. He can eat massive shots in the feet. But the issue is, how do we know he has a really good chin? He's been hit clean a lot throughout his career. And I remember Munhoz credited a lot of his own chin for... I trained with a national Brazilian boxing champion. Like, I have some really high-level boxing in my back pocket. Sean O'Malley's not going to play the boxing game with you, though. He's either all the way out or all the way in. And I think that does negate a lot of the advantages Munhoz has coming into this fight. But what I do like about this matchup is that if O'Malley is able to beat Pedro Munhoz, I do feel like it's going to eliminate that part of the conversation of, Well, they could land a leg kick and the fight's over. If you beat a guy like Pedro Munhoz, and let's say he leg kicks Sean O'Malley 5, 6, 7 times in the first round, and O'Malley knocks him out in the second or the third, let's say, that's like perfect situation for Sean O'Malley. I would much prefer that than him winning this fight via like 15-second knockout, because we'd learn a lot more about O'Malley in that situation. So I have Sugar, but this is a tough fight for him.
I did see that clip of Sean O'Malley on his podcast talking about a fan question about the Vera rematch and the leg kick, and he just kind of was really dismissive of it. And I'm sure in training he drills defending those time and again, because he does switch stances a lot, and especially when he's on the back foot, he's still a very accurate and heavy striker. So I do like O'Malley with the speed advantage in this one, but again, I laid out a game plan for Pedro Munhoz. I could do it either way, and if you see value in him as an underdog, maybe you end up with him. But both of us going with Sugar Sean O'Malley to get the win, bringing it back to the MMA lab. It should be a great fight. Strickland Pereira and the two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Make or break time for 5-1, 34-year-old, unranked Alex Pereira taking on a top-ranked caliber number 4 Sean Strickland in this middleweight division. And since his horrific motorcycle accident that took him out of commission for some time, Sean Strickland pulled a classic King of the Cage. What does that mean? Well, he used to be the King of the Cage middleweight champ, came into the UFC, had a foray there, moved down to 170, and you thought that was his home until that motorcycle accident. 185, he's 5-0 since then. He has some finishes mixed in there. He's looked absolutely amazing in the division. He just had a couple of big-time fights. Jack Hermanson, Uriah Hall, 5-round fights, and he won those fights handily. And now he's going to be taking on an interesting test in Pereira. And I open it up saying it's make or break time, because if Pereira loses this fight, I don't know what the hell the promotion does with him, because then all of a sudden it's not like, oh, well, you're going to fight Adesanya tomorrow. You might never fight him ever again, which, of course, they did fight in kickboxing, Pereira knocking out us.
I think that's a really good point to bring up, though, and I'm even curious to see, what if Pereira wins and so does Cannonier? Like, it feels like every time we talk about Alex Pereira and what's he going to do next, it's, hey, building towards Israel, building towards Israel. So I'm very curious to see, like, where does his story go if there is no Israel to build towards? Because for the majority of really hyped up prospects, it's, hey, beat the 11th ranked guy, then beat the 7th ranked guy. They don't get a top 5 opponent. And if you beat them, we'll talk about a title shot. But it is very curious that ever since Pereira got signed to the UFC, the conversation has only been around him potentially fighting Adesanya, more so than any of his opponents up until this point.
Now, his last time out, and a lot of people are going to say, well, Bruno Silva, bleh. Andres Mihailidis, bleh. Bruno Silva is a motherfucker, and the guy was the middleweight champ over with M1 Global. You can take that for what it's worth. He had a little bit of a USADA issue for a couple of years, but Bruno Silva.
Alexander Romanov who?
Good at grappling, good at jiu-jitsu, great at power punching, and they had a heck of a fight. And Alex Pereira, when the fight was standing and he wasn't clinched up or taken down, looked absolutely amazing. And same thing goes for his fight against Mihailidis. Mihailidis had a ton of success in the first round. He kind of pitter-patter a little bit with his kickboxing, worked in his takedowns, and then Pereira was able to light him up with a flying knee in the second round. But I look at it for Alex Pereira, and Mihailidis was only able to go 2 of 7 on his takedown attempts, and Bruno Silva was only able to go 2 of 8, and Pereira beat Bruno Silva 3 judges, 30-27 on each of their scorecards. So for Pereira, he's been able to grapple defensively enough, because you're never going to see him offensively grapple, from the school of Teixeira MMA and Fitness out of their Connecticut, you know, there. But I know Glover's not the champ anymore, and you might just want to, like, step aside and dismiss him. But what he's done there with that team is very impressive. It's just like James Krause. Is he the best UFC fighter ever? No, he's very successful, but his gym's very successful as well. For Pereira to mix it up, and you got to consider this too, because I'm saying, oh, depths in despair, 5-1 in MMA. 33-7 in kickboxing, 21 knockouts, and he was a former Glory middleweight and light heavyweight champ. Light heavyweight as recent as last year in 2021, he was their champ. So he's made the transition back over to MMA, because he did have an MMA fight years ago. Very, very well, and he's looked very good in these fights.
And I do like his takedown defense, because it's not just defensively oriented from on the feet. If he does get taken down, he's a very strong athlete for the size of him. I know he's got like a thin build to him. He doesn't look like the biggest guy in the world, but you can tell how naturally strong he is, because at 6'4 at the middleweight division, he towers over his opposition. It is kind of like watching a Kevin Durant play basketball, because he's hunched over a little bit. Like, Pereira does things wrong, but his athleticism can make them right. And I think it is very interesting, the matchmaking that they've done with Pereira up until this point, because we talked about this a lot. Like, Mikaelidis, oddly enough, stylistically might have been his toughest fight. A guy who's going to wrestle you more than anything, really. And a guy who's really going to try to wear on your gas tank and make it an ugly fight. Whereas with Souza, he's going to stand on the feet with you a little bit more. He'll play your game a little bit. So I do like how they've matched Pereira up in the UFC up until this point. But this fight against Sean Strickland is an odd one, because I think Pereira is a pure kickboxer to where he will struggle against like a Marvin Vettori, who's just so dedicated to the takedown that they don't really care about throwing punches. And I know Vettori is a good striker at this stage of his career, but you know what his mindset is. I'm going to get close to you. I'm going to get on top of you, and I'm going to beat you into the ground with my ground and pound. I think Pereira, with his striking style, would really struggle against a guy like Vettori, because he does jump into some of his strikes, and he will kind of jump into the pocket, for lack of a better term. Hide your ciabatta. But the thing is, with Pereira, he really only needs one. And I know people say this all the time. Oh, Francis just needs one. The difference is, some people are only a right-hand puncher, for instance. Deontay Wilder comes to mind, where, yes, he's a crazy knockout artist, but his main tool is that straight right, and then he gets wild afterwards. Pereira has knockout power, but it's not just associated with one tool. He can knock you out with his left leg, his right leg, elbows, punches. It doesn't matter where the punch is coming from or where the strike's coming from. It has the potential to knock you out behind it. And I'm kind of curious as to why they didn't make this fight a 5-round fight, and this is why. We've seen it happen. It's not common, especially for them to do non-title fights on pay-per-view main cards. It's happened a couple times.
Lawler Diaz.
But they are building Pereira up to fight for a UFC title, and normally you do see a fighter fight in a Fight Night main event or have some really high profile fights on their way up to the title shot that gets them ready for that kind of atmosphere. I am a little surprised they didn't end up making this fight a 25 minute fight, because Sean Strickland's been in that atmosphere before. It's not like we have to question the cardio of Sean Strickland, whether or not the fight's just going to look really ugly at that point. And B, it would help us learn a lot more about Alex Pereira, because let's say he does have a close fight with Strickland in the first 3 rounds, he looks tired in the fourth, and let's say he can stop Sean Strickland like the fourth or fifth round. That's going to make a lot of people who were maybe just a little bit curious in this kickboxing star fighting Israel Adesanya to, oh my goodness, Alex Pereira, the guy who knocked out Israel Adesanya, has a chance to do it again. So that's the only thing I will say. I did kind of expect this to be a 5-round main event, or a 5-round co-main event, after they had mentioned that this is a title eliminator, but I am curious to get your thoughts on that. Like, for Sean Strickland, what do you think his mindset is going into this fight? Because he himself hasn't fought a lot of the upper echelon guys, but he could also kind of jump that queue and get into a title shot just like that.
Like, if you like my favorite saying when you're watching any of the UFC broadcasts, it's you gotta watch DC and RC, a couple of Louisiana boys chopping it up about the sport they love. They never change the line. It's always the same. Sean Strickland, here's the line. I'll preface it with this. He always used to be a California guy, and he always used to be, whether it was Team Quest, which I get it, up north, but there's one in California, or Kings MMA. Since the middleweight move, he's been chopping it up at every damn gym across the country. Syndicate, Extreme Couture, American Top Team. He's been everywhere. And a lot of people credit his success to, okay, his boxing is great. When he's in the pocket, it's great. My big critique is he's squared up. Like, he's really squared up. I don't understand why guys don't have success kicking his leg. You know why? You know why, Craig? It's because as soon as somebody goes to land that kick, he throws volume with power behind it. Guys respect his power and they back off. Look at Jack Hermanson. Jack Hermanson sometimes gets lost when he meets volume. He looked completely lost when he took the volume of Sean Strickland. That was Strickland's last fight a few months ago, 4 months and a week ago, when he took on Uriah Hall. Again, 50-44, 50-45, 49-46. Uriah Hall couldn't get started. Christoph Jocko was on the back foot the whole fight. Couldn't figure it out. Brendan Allen got finished in that one. And then the fight against Jack Marshman, where this all kicked off about a year and a half ago. In the third round, he's toying with him. He's drawing with him, telling him to throw down. He looked like a middleweight Max Holloway in that fight. He really did look amazing. And I know Jack Marshman had a rough go in the UFC. But regardless of it, Sean Strickland's looked very, very good in these fights. So I look at the odds. Strickland opened a minus 175. Minus 103 right now on best fight odds. Alex Pereira, unranked, against the number 4 middleweight. Open to plus 150, minus 122. Matt, Sean Strickland in the UFC is 12-3. Those three losses, Santiago Ponzinibbio, Kamaru Usman, who out-wrestled him, and
dropped him on the feet, though.
Eliseo Zaleski dos Santos, who put him on a poster. Like, it's probably in somebody's house. The spinning wheel kick. It's definitely in Eliseo's house, and it's probably in a dance
studio. Eliseo has, like, an NFT of just him, like, spinning and knocking him out.
It's definitely in a Capoeira dance studio somewhere. Matt, we have a look at the fan vote. 50%!
Wow.
894 total votes, so split them with a hair. 75% of the fans who have Strickland have him to win by decision. 68% of the fans who have Pereira have him to win by knockout. Matt, I seem to come from that same school of thought. Strickland wins the decision, Pereira knocks him out. What do you say?
Pereira has an amazing chin. I just feel like we should say that. We see a lot of kickboxers come over and almost be a little overconfident with their level of striking. I don't think Pereira is in that camp whatsoever. Like, he fought one of the best non-ranked fighters in the UFC his last time out and ate some bombs from him, too. Yep. And, like, Silva's one of the more heavy-handed guys there is out there, and he was able to eat some really big shots from him, rally late in that fight, and did a lot of the things that you like out of a fighter that you're expecting to make a run towards the top of the division. I think the UFC strategically match-made this.
No way.
As good as any fight. Because that's the thing. Pereira is, of course, he's a 10 out of 10 in striking. But I think, okay, Israel Adesanya and Alex Pereira are both, let's just say, the same level of striker, if you will. Like, no one's going to go out there and just purely outstrike them on the outside. The difference is, Izzy moves with his feet planted flat on the ground for the most part, so it does help him with his takedown defense, and he has refined his process slightly throughout his almost 20 MMA fights now. Whereas for Pereira, he still does have some of those tendencies to jump into the pocket, which is something you do when you don't have to worry about the takedown. So against Sean Strickland, who also gets all of his work done in the pocket, I do think Pereira will be able to win this fight, but I'm very curious to see what they do with Pereira. What if he doesn't have an impressive win this time out? Dana White's sitting back like, hey, we want him in there with another guy. Like, maybe you do the Whitaker fight, but
Costa.
Costa would be a really good one now that I think about it. It's a great example. It's just, I still find this very weird how everything Pereira does is tied to this guy who has the title. Whereas for Adesanya, it doesn't really feel like Pereira is a part of his story, but everything about Pereira's story is him getting to the Adesanya fight. The pick is Alex Pereira. If you fight him in the pocket, you're probably going to go home asleep.
Yeah, it's a really, really odd one. You love the volume out of Sean Strickland. I know he did win a split decision his last time out against Jack Hermanson. Honestly, I didn't hear a ton of arguments for Hermanson winning that fight, so it is what it is. But against Uriah Hall, he bulldozed him. The biggest thing, if you do look at it for Sean Strickland, even against Brendan Allen, he was able to take him down, is facts that he can mix in his wrestling when he needs to. Pereira's not an easy guy to take down. Great use of underhooks when he gets back up against the cage. He's a tall guy that can use his frame well. He has a great base that he extends out. Like, he's not just a 5-1 fighter. Obviously,
I think people are going to be mad at this prediction, though. I feel like a lot of people out there are going to be like, hey, Sean Strickland with the experience, I can't believe you guys are picking the hype job. But, like, Sean Strickland gets all of his positives done in the pocket. Alex Pereira strikes like there's a thunderstorm outside your window. It's not a
what,
great
is he a
recipe.
Dog that's afraid of it?
Well, no, it just sounds constantly. It sounds like two wooden bats are hitting each other when Alex Pereira lands anything. Who was the poor guy who fought Pereira in his fight after Glory, but before he came to the UFC? You can find it on Tapology.
LFA Zone.
It was in LFA. It was awful. They matched Pereira up with a guy who had very limited experience, too.
Powell, who's 4-4.
Thomas Powell, God love you wherever you are.
He's all over Twitter. I see him there a lot.
Thank God he's doing well nowadays, because he fought Alex Pereira in one of the scariest fights I've ever seen in my life. It's like we have the greatest kickboxer of all time against a guy who's, what, well, I guess 4-3 at the time. And then, yeah, Pereira hits him with a left hook that straight up sounds like a crack of thunder or someone hit a whip inside the cage. Like, Pereira has fight-changing power if he lands, and Sean Strickland has good numbers. But you only really come down to the numbers if it goes to the decision. I expect Pereira to win by stoppage.
I think Pereira's going to win too. And this is weird, kind of, you know, coming into this one, thinking about it. Sean Strickland, 4th rank, mixed in the wrestling, training at Syndicate, Couture, American Top Team, I'm going to wrestle. Which is great because he can out-wrestle strikers. He out-wrestled Uriah Hall. He's out-wrestled guys in the past. He was able to take down Brendan Allen. I think Alex Pereira's going to win. It's completely outside of the realm of the way that Craig Allen picks fights. I always go experience, takedown versus guys who just have power. But I think Alex Pereira is going to get it done. And it sounds weird to me. So let me know in the comment section who you have in this matchup. But both of us kind of scratching our heads. And we're going with a guy who's, what, a few days away from turning 35. And Alex Pereira to get the win. I can't wait for this fight. And if you really want to see us either take an L or a big W, join in the Fight Night Picks sidekick. We're going to be live for the main card on YouTube. We're going to be chatting with you. So if we look like donkeys, you can see it there. Two big title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, great things happen in threes. And for us, luckily enough, we get a third iteration of Alexander Volkanovski and Max Holloway. Thank you so much for joining Fight Night Picks this weekend, Matt. Question Mark Kicks last weekend, amazing. A ton of people tuned in. We had a lot of fun jumping into the chat. You can catch that 2 hours before the prelims. QMK, if you ever see it on our channel, that's what it is. That's what it means. There's that pop-up in this video, but you should check it out. But Matt, when it comes down to this fight, the first fight between these two guys was UFC 245, December 2019. Number two was UFC 251, July of 2020. And since these two had fought, whether you thought that Volkanovski won the first fight or Holloway, and the same thing goes for the second fight, you could split them with a hair. Very, very close. Very well matched. Awesome fights. These two guys have looked like world beaters in their last two fights. For Alexander Volkanovski, withstands the choke from hell against Brian Ortega just to beat the brakes off him in that fight. And when it comes to his last fight, did he retire the Korean Zombie? I don't know, but he beat him so soundly, finished him in the fourth round. That fight wasn't all that long ago, just a little over 2 months ago for Volkanovski. For Max Holloway, sets a record for significant strikes landed in a fight against Calvin Kattar, just continues to rack up those totals. And then he fights Yair Rodriguez 7 months ago in a fight where most people, myself included, didn't think Yair Rodriguez stood a snowball's chance in hell. And boy, oh boy, was that a good fight, Matt. Did you enjoy it?
You're using a lot of my terms. It was a great fight, but I'm going to disagree. A world beater would suggest that you beat everybody and nothing's close. Volkanovski almost got choked out twice against Ortega and kind of got dropped against him too. And everybody thought he was going to beat the Korean Zombie. So I'm not that surprised by what we know now with Alexander Volkanovski. What I will say though is he has been grappling slightly more than he was when he first won the title, which does remind me a lot of his earlier run in the UFC before he fought Jose Aldo and Chad Mendes, back to when he fought the likes of like Jeremy Kennedy and Darren Elkins. He used his wrestling a lot more in those matchups compared to now because he is such a good striker. It's kind of like when you hear Jose Aldo has a jiu-jitsu black belt. He's had it for 15 years. That's cool and all, but when you're as good as Jose Aldo at striking, why the hell would you ever take anybody down? Because you really don't ever need to worry about it. The one thing I do think that will be different about this fight than the previous two is that I do expect Volkanovski to go for a lot more offensive takedowns. And just looking at their first two fights quick, I thought Volkanovski easily won the first fight. I genuinely don't see why there was any controversy around their first fight. I thought Volkanovski kind of easily won four rounds to one, right, if we're being honest, because he shut down a lot of the offense of Max Holloway. Remember, he was using the leg kicks. He made Holloway switch stances. Like, he was able to do the counter of a lot of the positives that Max Holloway normally does. The second fight, I'll be honest, I thought Holloway did win that fight. I thought he was able to drop Volkanovski multiple times throughout that fight, and I thought he did enough to win three of the five rounds. But again, that fight was extremely close for both guys. They both landed some great shots.
And I thought the first fight, 3-2 for Volkanovski as well. Well, second fight, 3-2 for Holloway. But the craziest part about it is, if you believe Max Holloway, doing all the training sessions for the second fight on Zoom. So a little wild there. And obviously, you know, former, UFC buddy from Hawaii at the same time, Martin Day, tried to do that. And it did not work out for him against Davey Grant. But when it does come down to this fight, Matt, for Volkanovski, this is a guy that's kind of like low-key building a championship, like Hall of Fame resume, beating guys, like you said, Jose Aldo, Chad Mendes, Max Holloway's, the Korean Zombies, the Brian Ortegas. And you look at it, 10 bonuses for, a guy like Max Holloway. He had the double bonus against Brian Ortega. You don't see those very often. 8 title fights, 6-2 in those. Obviously, loses to Volkanovski, loses to Volkanovski, and then against Dustin Poirier, I guess so really, it is 6-3. And if you do look at it for Volkanovski, he's had 4 title fights, he's won all of them. It comes down to this big-time matchup in this fight where Volkanovski, you saw him last weekend in Vegas with Adesanya sitting next to him, all the boys from City Kickboxing, cheering on Carlos Ulbricht, giant win over Tafan Chukwe. They want to keep that storm coming, they want to keep that wave rolling for the great Volkanovski. No longer is he the thick boy rugby player, he is a toned machine at 145. And again, but this is one of those ones, and I heard this brought up by, and I'm going to give credit where credit's due, Brian Campbell, you got Luke Thomas, you got the man in the hat, Chuck Mindenhall. They were talking about it. Will one of these guys look old this weekend? It was going to be one of my talking points, but I kind of heard them flesh it out. I think it's an interesting one because Holloway looks so good against Kattar. Had a great fight against Yair Rodriguez.
Here's my question. If we can just stay on that for a second. Do you think that fight was Holloway maybe reaching a plateau? Not necessarily regressing, but just being the guy we thought. Or was that Yair kind of becoming the fighter that we all thought he could be?
We're going to find that out in the next month when Rodriguez takes on Ortega when we have this fight. I think that's all I can say because I'm not a clairvoyant.
But still, that would kind of help us figure out if Max Holloway looked good. That's why I ask you.
I I think we're starting to get to that point. I mean, again, the guy came into the UFC at, what, 20? Now he's 30. He's had a multitude of fights. I talked about it. 10 bonuses. Like, you don't have 10 bonuses without going through some crazy stuff. And these aren't just like, okay, he has 10 bonuses and 9 of them are performance bonus first-round knockouts. No, this guy's having fight of the night after fight of the night. Giving a lot of damage, but receiving a lot as well. The McGregor fight's a big example of one. The Poirier fights are examples. Like, but when you look at it for Volkanovski, the guy's so damn defensively sound, he's a shell out there.
But the problem is he has been getting hit lately, and that was a big talking point for me going into the Korean Zombie fight. Volkanovski gets hurt on the feet. It does happen. Even before he became champion, he was susceptible to big shots, and Max Holloway proved that. He was able to drop him right near the end of the first round and basically right at the end of the second round in their second fight. I just don't know what version of Holloway we're going to get, because it is very obvious. Both of these guys have to fight in a different manner when they fight each other compared to when they fight everybody else. That's how skilled these two guys are. Because if Holloway goes in with that, I'm gonna flood him with my output. I'm just gonna put so much on him that he can't react to it. Well, Volkanovski is an all-time good chin. He does have all-time good striking defense. And B, he can go for takedowns, get under your strikes, and really make you pay for them. And the flip side is, Volkanovski can't really sit on a lot of his shots, and he can't really go for a lot of takedowns against a guy like Max Holloway, because on the flip side, Holloway, great footwork, very long for the division, really intelligent guy too, and that has to be said for both guys. That's kind of the missing piece when you talk about a fighter's skill set before they become a champ. It's, hey, they're good at wrestling, they're good at jiu-jitsu, they're good at striking, but how smart are they at putting all three of those things together? These are two of the fighters that have kind of reached the pinnacle of becoming mixed martial artists, because even though Volkanovski is naturally a striker, and say they would Max Holloway, they can beat guys with their grappling, they can beat guys with their clinch, they can overwhelm guys with their cardio, and that's what makes this fight so good. You can put these guys together 15 times, I don't care what the result is, it's always going to make for an entertaining fight because they're so skilled in every area of the sport.
Hopefully none of those 15 are draws, and hopefully this one this weekend isn't either, unless it's a wild fight or no contest or an eye poke or whatever. But when I do look at it, Holloway's weird because he's got a long frame, he's got long legs, he's got short arms. Like, Artem MMA is going to love this, but like Artem Lobov, really, really tiny arms at 145. But Holloway does have shorter arms, but he understands his legs so damn well that it doesn't really matter. And for Volkanovski in the entries, Holloway can crouch, still keep his base, keep that takedown defense, and work that volume. And listen, you don't need me to tell you that. You saw that in two other fights. But when it does come down to this one, let's let the odds tell a story. Volkanovski favorite, open minus 145, minus 190 right now. For Holloway, open plus 125, plus 155. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise us there to you. I haven't thrown this one out to the YouTube community tab, but I will. So look out for that on our YouTube channel in the community tab. Look at that. 921 total votes, 72% Volkanovski, 79% by decision for the 28% that of Holloway, 82% by decision. So a guy wins the first two fights. Listen, we talked about this, Matt. We talked about this on the live show, question mark kicks. We said, how many times has somebody won the first two fights, and then what happened after that? Well, Vanderlei Silva beat Rampage Jackson in their first two fights, and then Rampage won the next two. So maybe this is Max Holloway's Rampage.
I hope to God we don't see part four of this in Bellator.
That one was so bad.
Oh, my goodness. If we see Volkanovski versus Holloway at welterweight in Bellator in 5 years, I'm going to be pissed off. But the good news is we get the Trilogy 4 UFC title in both guys' relative primes. This is the difference between both fighters, though, or at least what I believe. Max Holloway, I think, has plateaued as a fighter. Nothing wrong with that. When you're an all-time great, it's going to kind of get hard to keep on improving when you're an all-time great. And I kind of liken this fight a little bit to Canelo versus Triple G. Because Max Holloway, like Triple G, got started early, was a phenom, and had a lot of really hard fights. But at a certain point, you do kind of just become the fighter that you are because you are so skilled in all these other areas. Whereas Alexander Volkanovski is constantly getting better. And as you are this dominant champion, he's watching you. And he has something to aspire to constantly. It's what The Last Dance is about. The Last Dance is just a documentary about a guy who's so good at something he doesn't want to do it anymore and has to find added motivation. Because that's really the key when you're an upper echelon athlete for years. You have to be motivated to keep on doing this time in, time out. For Volkanovski, I think the whole time Holloway was champion, was this dominant champion, at a young age, we're all talking about Holloway as, hey, like, how good will he be? It wasn't like, is he going to be in the Hall of Fame? It's, where on Mount Rushmore are we going to put Max Holloway? Holloway's face. That was the development plan for how good Holloway was as a title. That constantly gave Alexander Volkanovski something to aspire to, something to fight towards. And I do think that by now he is the slightly more well-rounded guy. I expect more takedowns out of Volkanovski because I do think he trusts his own gas tank. He's one of the few guys who can work a hard 25 minutes with Max Holloway. Most fighters can go 25 minutes with Max Holloway, but he's going to have that 4 or 5 minute avalanche to where he puts such a space between him and you that you're never going to be able to cover the distance. I don't think Volkanovski's that fighter. I think he can negate some of Holloway's advantages with his leg kick and with his takedowns. I expect this to be an incredible fight, but I am slightly favoring Volkanovski.
I think it's going to be another close one. I think you're going to have people splitting hairs once more, and I don't see a guy having such a big edge and advantage, but when I do look at this one, you talk about The Last Dance. Hopefully Alexander Volkanovski, when it's all said and done, isn't like Australia's Luke Longley and they just forget about him. But Matt, I do agree. Both of us going with Alexander Volkanovski. The and still, is it the popular pick? Let us know down below in that comment section. You guys fill that up every single weekend. The likes mean something. The comments mean something. Subscribe at your own risk or peril. But we have a big time week planned. Obviously, Cannonier challenging Adesanya for the belt up at the top, City Kickboxing Zone. But we also have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims and the Fight Night Pick Sidekick, where we go live and talk about the fights during that main card. So you can join us here on the channel. You keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Absolute banger. Coming up this weekend at UFC 276 in the main event, Israel Adesanya looking to hold on to his middleweight strap, taking on a fresh challenger. And this is what we love. It's the killer gorilla, Jared Cannonier, a guy who has had a wild MMA career from early beginnings in Alaska, coming into the UFC at heavyweight, getting knocked out by Sean Jordan in his debut, going down to 205, losing to Jan Blachowicz and Dominic Reyes, and then making the move down to 185 and finding a home. And if you look at it for Cannonier and you consider his last five fights, I'm going to talk about them. I mean, wins over Anderson Silva, Jack Hermanson, a loss to Robert Whittaker, win over Kelvin Gastelum, and Derek Brunson his last time out in the title eliminator. And Brunson was like, look, I've got two fights left. We're going to see how it happens. And in the first round, Derek Brunson rocks Jared Cannonier and drops him. And in the second round, Jared Cannonier goes, I'm just a wild man with crystals and an aura of steel. And in that one, he's able to rally back and finish Jared Brunson. And Brunson looked completely gassed in that second round. But Cannonier able to finish him off and looked amazing. For Israel Adesanya, since losing to Jan Blachowicz, he beats Marvin Vettori. He beats Robert Whittaker soundly in their second fight. But Matt, I absolutely love this matchup because it's so much more fun to see a new challenger than some of the recycled names up at the top of the middleweight division.
100%. I do think this should be an enjoyable fight for as long as it lasts, because for Jared Cannonier, he has shown a really nice ability at 185, not only to knock out his opponents, but he has fixed the one hole that plagued him in the other weight classes. He was an awful wrestler up at 205 and 100, and at heavyweight. But at 185 pounds, his physical strength is undeniable. Like, when guys go to take him down and he digs those underhooks, there's not a man alive who can break that hold from him, because he is so physically strong with his takedown defense that it really has been able to accentuate his striking on the feet and allow him to really focus on that one area. And like you said, even go back to the Derek Brunson fight. Derek Brunson was using a lot of ducks into his own strikes to kind of threaten with the takedown. But once he started to tire down, even a little bit, Cannonier jumped on him, and the second he pounced on him for the kill, the fight was pretty much over. And that's what I do like about Jared Cannonier. He has a very high finishing ability if he has his opponent hurt. And I know that might be weird to hear, because after the Anderson Silva win, he wasn't necessarily going for the knockout as much, even in the Robert Whittaker fight. I know in the third round he rallied a little bit in that last minute or so, but he was losing that fight quite handily throughout it. What I do like about Cannonier, though, is once he has a guy wobbled, he is very intelligent about finishing them. He doesn't just rush in and try to throw a crazy combination to win automatically. He'll stay very patient, work behind a single shot. And I think that's really important against a guy like Israel Adesanya, who, in the few times that we have seen him hurt in the UFC, guys kind of panic. They get so excited that, oh my goodness,
this isn't supposed to happen.
You're like, Kelvin Gastelum's like, I head kicked Adesanya. What? Like, Rafael Cordero probably pumps his guys up as much as anybody in the gym. Like, Cordero's a positive guy. He's the type of guy who, when you hit his glove on the last combination, he'll loosen it a little bit so you hit it across the room. But, like, he must have been pumping Jared Cannonier up for that fight. But
Diamond-tipped tires.
But what I like about Cannon here is he has great takedown defense, which it probably won't come into play a lot in this fight, but he has very good defensive striking too. And I do think that's really the first thing I've talked about when you're fighting a guy like Israel Adesanya is how small can you leave the windows open for a guy like Adesanya? Because that's all he's waiting for. He's trying to set you up to overextend yourself to make a mistake. And then your first mistake, last mistake, to quote Dave Mustaine, is normally how Israel Adesanya is able to win his fights. But that's the thing that I'm going to say, and this is how I'll leave it to you. I'm a little worried that this fight might be a little boring, because if you look back at the Yoel Romero fight, it was a fighter who has a lot of power, who doesn't throw a lot of volume, who fights in a bit of a defensive shell. Well, that's kind of what Jared Cannonier is, too. And I do worry that if Cannonier doesn't let his own hands go, we are going to see a very similar fight to the Yoel Romero-Israel Adesanya matchup.
I mean, to move forward with the song quote from Megadeth, who have an album coming out this year.
I didn't know that.
First mistake, no more mistakes. When you look at Jared Cannonier, he has 5 knockdowns in the UFC. He is a winning fighter. He's going to be fighting for the title. He's also been knocked down 5 times. Like,
higher weight classes than this one, though.
There is a yin and a yang. Obviously, Brunson dropped him their last time out. When you look at it, Cannonier extended himself, and Brunson threw the weirdest shot. Like, it was almost like he took an oar from a boat and swung it sideways, because he swung his right arm, hit him with the side of his fist, dropped him, and then he followed up with it. When you look at the way that Cannonier hurt Brunson, Cannonier catches an elbow in the clinch. Brunson is already tired. He's wobbled. And then Cannonier is reserved. He doesn't just run after the kill. He picks his shots. He lands another elbow. And then once the fight's down on the mat, I haven't seen referee Kerry Hatley doing a lot of UFC fights, but referee Kerry Hatley let too many back fists go.
Clean elbows just like on the ground.
Disgusting. It was like, well, Kerry liked Brock Lesnar when he was in the UFC. I like what Jared's doing, so let's let that go some more. But yeah, I do liken it to that Yoel Romero fight, because Cannonier fights with a defensive style always. You go to kick to the body, he's very quick to duck down. When he swooped against Robert Whittaker at 55 seconds of the first round of their fight, he broke his ulna. But the guy fought with a broken ulna till the end of the fight, so you know how tough Jared Cannonier is. But when you look at this matchup, yeah, I mean, for Adesanya, the lateral movement, the in and out, like, all of those things are there. And if it just comes to pure striking, there's not many people in this division that hold a candle to Israel Adesanya.
This is the interesting part about this fight, though. Jared Cannonier checks leg kicks and throws very good leg kicks himself. Adesanya does rely on that a lot when he's fighting guys who don't open up with their own hands. So, again, this almost might play more into this fight might not be the most exciting, because let's say Adesanya, he's throwing some jabs, he's having okay success on the outside, but hitting a lot of arms. Well, normally Izzy's next plan B is, okay, go to leg kicks and start working those. If Cannonier is checking the leg kick from the outside, I'm very curious to see what is the next step of Adesanya's kind of evolution with his game, because it normally goes boxing, kicks, and then I mix the two together once you make a mistake. In this fight, it almost might have to be in reverse, start out kicking, see if he can defend that, and then add some other tools into the game. So I do like in this fight either the Brad Tavares fight or the Yoel Romero one, because in the Brad Tavares fight, it was kind of close. Tavares isn't the easiest guy to hit clean, especially early on in fights, but every minute the fight went by, Brad Tavares got a little bit more tired, a little bit more tired, a little bit more tired. And when you're 100%, when you wake up in the morning, you're pretty alert, right? Right before you go to bed at night, you're probably not that alert because it's been a long day. Jared Cannonier's fighting style is very similar to a long day at work. In the morning, he's going to be good. He's going to be all there. But I do think that as this fight does go on, his hands are going to come down a little bit more and a little bit more. He's going to be more wary of the body shot. He's going to be more wary of just all the offensive tools that Adesanya has at his disposal. And I do expect later on in this fight for Izzy to maybe not get a knockout, but I do think his combinations will start to land the fourth and fifth round. And whether that leads to a stoppage or not, I do think that they'll be able to land some really big shots.
Yeah, and when you look at Cannonier's fight against Kelvin Gastelum, a guy who's had some great fights and a guy who's had some odd fights.
It's been a while.
It's kind of been everywhere and in between. You look at the Cannonier fight against Gastelum as a main event from last year, and Cannonier was able to drop him in the third round. Volume totals are really low for both guys, so a little bit of a chess match there. When you're taking on a guy like Adesanya, you got to do something. Could it be the threat of the takedown to then work his strikes? Could it be a clinch situation to try and get him up against the fence? Like, Vittori was able to back up Adesanya, but he wasn't able to do anything with it. He wasn't able to land much in terms of volume. He wasn't able to get many of the takedowns. What can Cannonier do to figure out Adesanya? Because Adesanya doesn't always have to rely on forward pressure. There's fighters out there like Sean O'Malley on this card. He can strike on the back foot, land with power and volume and accuracy. Those guys and gals are few and far between. Adesanya, O'Malley, a couple of guys like that that are cut from that.
And that's what I keep on going back to. So for Jared Cannonier, I think a lot of his focus is going to have to be defensively early on in this fight. But if it is defensively, because he does like to keep his hands up high, that's going to leave the body kick open a lot for Adesanya. And yes, Cannonier can check leg kicks, but I do think that body is going to be wide open for Adesanya to get after. And let's say he's not landing a lot to the head or to the leg in the first round, but he is making use of that body shot. That is going to, again, make Cannonier think about that extra layer of striking defense. Probably going to make him move his hands a little bit more. It might even make him more desperate as the fight goes on, because you realize is okay. I'm getting hit with a front kick. I'm kind of getting prodded at as this fight continues. So I do think early on it might be boring. I'll say round 4 and 5 could be really exciting. But no matter how exciting or how boring the fight is, I still go back to favoring Adesanya at most of the ranges.
This could be one of those weird fights like Nami Yunus Esparza where nothing happens. And then at the end of it, you go, well, Adesanya won. And then the judges read a scorecard for Cannonier and everybody's upset and irate. Like the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 main events. Holm, Vieira, Cater, Emmett, the last one that you had, Zarukian and Gamrot. Things have been all over the place in the sport of MMA. When you look at the odds for this fight, Adesanya open to minus 300, minus 395 right now on best fight odds. For Cannonier, open to plus 250, plus 300. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you, Matt, but I'm going to say over under 85% Adesanya.
I think it'll be 90.
It's going to be 91% going with Adesanya. There's 909 total votes on that one. So, I mean, listen, the fans overwhelmingly going with Israel Adesanya to get the win. But that's not all, Matt, because in these main events, we always toss this one out there to the YouTube community tab for you folks that are following along at home. You can join in the community tab and have your say. We post polls quite often. We have more votes. 1,200 total votes, 84% Adesanya, 16% Cannonier. Some of the comments on there. JC Gamer, I kind of see it being like Adesanya versus Costa, where Cannonier just can't land anything significant. And Adesanya picks him apart with leg kicks. I think Adesanya will win by KO. But I could also see a win via decision for Adesanya. So thank you for throwing that out there. Chad, the UFC dad, who's always in the comments section. The playbook is out on how to beat Izzy. And if Jared can translate that to heavyweight frame, hold Adesanya down for 3 out of 5 rounds like Jan did, I could see an upset. But with that said, Izzy via, I'm not going to say it, but quite handily. Gerald Lynch, a vote here costs nothing. Watch who draws the real wager. By the time, Jared will probably be a plus 400 underdog. And I'll go with one more, Matt. Bob saying Adesanya by leg kicks. Matt, I agree with you. I think leg kicks are a little bit of an oddity because, like you said, Cannonier does check leg kicks, and Cannonier is thunderous leg kicks.
Like,
in his own.
I'm not here to say, like, oh, I'm really smart or good at this by
any
means.
No, and I don't want to disagree with the fans.
But that's been my big thing that no one's really talked about, and I'm really surprised about it. Like, Cannonier's great at throwing offensive leg kicks to the point that he stopped Anderson Silva with one. And he also checks them defensively. But for some reason, Israel Adesanya is the guy who's going to be able to do it time after time. Now, if he throws combinations with his hands and then ends it with a leg kick, then of course, it's going to be almost impossible for Jared Cannonier to predict exactly what Adesanya is throwing in combination form. But again, just standing in the middle of the cage, strike for strike, I do think Cannonier is an intelligent enough fighter to just be sound defensively early on. And again, I don't mean that's... I don't say that to mean that he's going to win the early rounds. I just don't think he's going to take a lot of damage in them either. Now, as the fight continues, as he gets tired, maybe the hands do come down and he is more susceptible to a big shot, but I think Adesanya has one of his most comfortable stylistic matchups he's had in a long time when he fights Cannonier.
So coming up this weekend, both of us going with Nigeria and New Zealand's own. There wasn't enough room in that title box there, so I went New Zealand, but you know the drill. Israel Adesanya to get the win. I can't wait for the fight. Question mark kicks have been popping off the last couple of weeks. That's 2 hours before the prelims on the channel. Make sure you check out that show. We have a lot of fun over there. That chat fills up and we try and answer as many questions, comments as we can. But if you missed that, or if you want to join in, the sidekick, the Fight Night Picks sidekick for the main card of the pay-per-view cards, we go live, we're here on YouTube, we're watching fights, we're hanging out, we're having the conversation with you as well. It's the best part of the week, it's the best part of the channel for me, because it's not just me talking into a camera, we actually get to talk to the folks out there. Matt, I know there's so many good fights on this card, but if I could really just put you in a corner, what's your favorite one that you can't miss?
I'm really excited for Alex Pereira versus Sean Strickland. Again, like I said, I really enjoy when you have a fight on the main card that just sort of sets you up for what the next title fight's going to be. No matter who wins this main event between Jared Cannonier and Israel Adesanya, their likely next opponent is going to be either Sean Strickland or Alex Pereira. And I really like that because we just have a very clear mind as to, okay, what's next? That's why I like tournaments in MMA. MMA matchmaking's so odd. You can have ranked fighters fighting unranked fighters. They can fight above their ranking, below their ranking, any which way in between. I really like it when there's some sort of a game plan or roadmap into, okay, if this guy wins this fight, he'll fight that person. If he beats that person, then maybe he'll get a title shot. I really like how this card seems to be set up in that fashion.
Give me the old guys. It's Miller time, the champagne of beers. Donald Cerrone, Jim Miller on short notice at 170. I like a little bit of weird, but if you like the old guy fights, Robbie Lawler, Ryan Barberena, they're going to throw down. Not to say that Barberena's old, but Robbie Lawler is a man. He's 40. So many good fights coming up this weekend. The podcast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Really want to thank everybody so much for joining in. An extra long edition of Fight Night Picks. You're going to want to keep it locked in. And as we always say, let's get into it.